the man with the game information. Gaming Steve, Gaming Steve. Xbox, Nintendo, PC, or PlayStation. Gaming Steve, Gaming Steve. Giving the news to the nerd generation. Gaming Steve. Give me news.
Give me news.
Give me views.
Give me views.
Gaming Steve.
Gaming Steve. He got the game.
What's to see?
What to see?
What to me?
What to me?
Gaming Steve.
Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for the hardest working man in the game industry, the one-man vortex of gaming information, the man who went out with Zelda and then dumped her, ladies and gentlemen, Gaming Steve!
Hey there, welcome to Gaming Steve, the home of intelligent game discussion. I'm your host, Stephen Glicker, and in this week's show, I have all the latest gaming news. I have a roundtable discussion with Peter Moore from Xbox and Microsoft. I then have a preview and detailed overview of the Microsoft campus, where I go through what I saw at Microsoft and Battle for Middle-Earth 2 for the Xbox 360. I then have an interview with Lewis Castle, the vice president of Electronic Arts, and one of the co-founders of Westwood Studios. I then have a review of the DS Lite. I then have the weekly Name That Game contest. Then I answer your questions in show mail, and then final thoughts. So, wow, that is a jam-packed show. I'm looking at this. This is like five shows in one. I have an interview with Peter Moore, interview with Lewis Castle, who's basically the guy who created almost the RTS genre. He created Dune 2 and Command & Conquer, for those of you who aren't familiar with him. So, yeah, if you like real-time strategy games, you got to talk to this guy and listen to the interview with him. I then go through what it was like to be on the Microsoft campus and what I saw and did there, and go through a preview of Battle for Middle-Earth 2 for the 360, which is like one of the very first real-time strategy games for consoles. There have been a couple in the past. Command & Conquer came out for the original PlayStation, I believe, and believe it or not, StarCraft came out for the Nintendo 64. And a lot of people like that version because it has, I believe, every single map ever made for StarCraft in one collection. And I don't know how great the graphics are because it's kind of weird. But if you really want to get a rare, you know, version of StarCraft, that's the one to get, is get your N64 and StarCraft. I remember when they were showing it on the game floor at E3. It was a pretty big deal back then. But I don't know anyone who ever had it. Even I don't have that game. I probably should look for it. I wonder if it's one of those games that's super cheap on eBay or super duper crazy expensive, like hundreds and hundreds of bucks. I'm going to check it out. And then, of course, the DS Lite, which I'm going to review because I got mine sitting right here. And wow, without giving away too much of the review, I can tell you this thing is pretty damn amazing. And then I have named the game and show mail. Wow, this is a crazy show. Well, let's get into the news and just get started.
Gaming news.
So first up, Dungeons & Dragons Online is adding new solo play. So those of you who haven't played the new MMO Dungeons & Dragons Online, Stormreach, it was developed by Turbine, who were the guys who made the Asheron's Call and a few other games. And the game has been getting mediocre reviews. One of the big issues with this MMO is that you have to play it kind of in a group setting. Because Dungeons & Dragons, as you probably all know, even if you have never played it, is a group game. You don't have to sort of party in a group. And the new 3.5 rules, which is what this is based on, is really designed for parties of 4 to 6 players. You can play more or less, but it's really tweaked for 4 players to 6 in most cases. Like all the rule books are designed for parties of 4 and etc. And they designed it so much like the original Dungeons & Dragons, or the new Dungeons & Dragons, should I say, is that you have to group. You just have to. And a lot of people didn't like that. Is that, you know, a lot of people like to play these games solo. So they listened to everyone. They added the solo play. They also made it a little bit easier for people to play by themselves. Now, I never played in the beta, and I never played it. So after hearing this, I downloaded the free trial, which is a 7-day free trial, and I tried it out. Because, believe it or not, I am a huge Dungeons & Dragons fan. Not just original, but I am actually playing a 3.5 campaign with a couple of my friends right now, and I'm the DM. I know, it's crazy. We actually meet once a week. It's totally random which day. We never meet on the same day twice, it seems. But yeah, I'm DMing this group. I'm taking them through actually a campaign from Dungeon Magazine, and it's really cool. They're actually up to level 5, and it's going to eventually bring them all the way up to like level 20, 21, 22. And it's going to probably take like a year to finish, but we're up to like the 11th session, and we keep going. So you can see I'm a hardcore D&D geek, of course. It's funny, we never played that much, but I went to Icon, if you remember, a few months ago. I actually spoke there, and they had a lot of gaming, and we played some D&D, and it was so much fun, we decided to sort of give it a try, and I decided to I'll DM. So back to this is, I gave it a try because, you know, I'm really familiar now with the 3.5 rules, and they supposedly take the rules and make them perfect for the online world, and the game's okay. The game's pretty good. I would definitely give it a try. It does a lot of really cool things, like you really feel like you're playing Dungeons & Dragons, and it actually has a DM that sort of narrates what you're doing, and I haven't gotten into the really in-depth content yet, but I kind of like it. I know a lot of people sort of been saying negative things about it, but because it has a lot of weird, it does a lot of things strangely because it just adapts to 3.5 D&D rules so well that, you know, it sort of breaks a lot of your standard MMO conventions. So yeah, I would definitely download this one and give it a try if you're curious to see what it's like. And the solo content, yeah, I haven't fooled around with it too much. I only started this weekend, so I got to play with it a bit more. But you know, this is good. I would say what happened is that they were always planning on putting solo content in, is that they just ran out of time. I mean, one thing about MMOs and the guys who make them, and they always say this, is that one of the big advantages is that you can patch it at will and keep adding content whenever you want. So most MMOs are released not completed. I can't think of too many that really were released even close to being completed. You know, let's see, even like, you know, City of Villains, City of Heroes, you know, they released it where you can only get up to level 40, and they even admit, like, you know, they just didn't finish it, and then by the time, you know, later they put in the stuff where you can get up to level 50. You know, World of Warcraft, you know, did a lot of stuff. They keep adding more and more stuff. You know, I'd say it took them over a year before they really, quote, finished the game, you know, really at the high levels, like levels 50, around 50 to 60s, there weren't a huge number of quests, especially like 56, 57. It was pretty lacking, but then they added a whole bunch recently. You know, they just keep adding more and more content, and that's it. I think the D&D, they had to release it, and they just thought, you know, what's the big deal? They'll put solo playing it a few months later anyhow, but it just goes to show you really need a good strong launch, because having a bad launch is really, really hard to recover from. And I'd say they've had sort of a mediocre to poor launch, unfortunately, just by the numbers I'm looking at. But that doesn't mean that the game is not dead. No, by no means. Look at EVE Online, which is like having huge resurgence, and I've seen other games come back from the brink. By the way, anyone playing The Matrix Online? Well, enough for that. So let's see what's next. Wii price and date is to be announced by September. And it's been confirmed that they're going to release the price and the official date on which the Wii's coming out in September. And I do find it curious that they keep, you know, maybe they were going to say it during E3, but then after when they saw what the PS3 was, they're like, whoa, let's take our time. Let's you know, create news when we need to. Let's not be reactionary. Let's just sort of do it when we want to. And you know, right now, all we know is that it's going to launch sometime in the fourth quarter of this year, and it's going to be less than $250. It's going to launch in November. It'll probably be $249. What I'm curious is are they going to do a bundle like everyone else is going to do? Is it going to be like $249 or for the regular version, or if you're going to have a deluxe version that maybe comes with an extra controller, so maybe it comes with two controllers, maybe a game or two, a few other bells and whistles, and maybe that'll be $350 or $349. I wonder if Nintendo's going to go the same route then. That Sony and Microsoft have been going the last, for the last two consoles, or their consoles, the PS3 and the 360. But yeah, Nintendo, man, they really, it just shows you how important it is to, quote, win E3, or at least come away from E3 with a positive buzz, because they're like all over the place. They've been mentioned, I've been reading them in magazines, talking about the Wii, people are excited about it. It was in New York Times about how it's going to finally change gaming, and they're getting just so much good press. And you know what? Maybe it won't be. Maybe the Wii will be a huge failure. Who knows? But the point is that they're putting on a really good show, and they're getting a lot of attention. And the PS3 is getting a lot of negative attention. They're getting attention because of the price and how it's really messing up the cycle. And I was actually, yesterday was Father's Day, and I was talking to my father about this, and he was saying he saw a documentary on video games and how the next generation console is really messing up all the, you know, not to buy the stocks, and they're really going down, and they're getting freaking tanked. For any of you guys out there, video game stocks, I don't have a ton of them, but, you know, Electronic Arts has just been getting crushed, and it basically gets boiled down to the PS3, just showing you what one thing can do and how it can affect millions and billions of dollars and millions of people worldwide. So, God, I hope Nintendo and Sony know what they're doing. Speaking of EVE Online, EVE Online actually went into China and broke records. EVE Online is such an interesting MMO. This thing came out. It came out a couple of years ago. You know, it was not that big a deal. And then they started to advertise recently quite a bit. They expanded it. They had some pretty interesting press because they had, like, this whole coup going on where this guy was hired to, like, assassinate these guild leaders, this corporation they're called in that game, set of guilds, and, you know, steal some incredibly valuable ships because things in this game are worth real money and they're really worth a ton. And that was getting a lot of press. They've been advertising in really, really great places. They've been doing good advertising, and then they grew. They grew quite a bit. They added several thousand subscribers in the last couple of months. And now they're in China, and they have over 200,000 registrants on the very first day of beta and over 30,000 concurrent users. Now, how it works in China is that when these MMOs come out is – they always come out in, quote, beta form. But what really that means is that they come out. Because China's a little different. You guys know all this by now. You know, you go and you don't pay to play games in China or South Korea. Most of them are, almost all of them, you actually play for free. The games are already pre-installed on your PCs. You go to, like, the PC cafes. They're called Bangs or Bongs in South Korea. I don't know what they're called in China. But you go there, the games are pre-installed, and you just log on, you play. And the games are usually either completely free, and then you actually pay for extra content, or you can pay for items, or you can actually buy gaming cards that give you time onto your account. Usually you go to these banks, and they'll have cards behind the counter, and they're like calling cards, and like you say, okay, I want to buy 1,000 hours of World of Warcraft, or, well, that's a lot, but maybe like 10 hours or 50 hours on playing on World of Warcraft, and you buy these cards, and they have codes, and you scratch them off, and then you enter in the codes, and then they give you time, because it's a cash society. I mean, no one has credit cards, or very few people have credit cards outside of Hong Kong and China. You know, they just really don't have billing. You know, it's just a totally different society. It's really cash-based, so they have to adapt. So what they do is they release these games sort of in what's called beta, you know, which is really they release the games and they're just free. What that really means is, okay, you can play this game. It's out now. It's completely free, and you can get most, if not all, the content. Eventually, then, they also test out, you know, the servers, make sure everything's working okay. And then a few weeks or months later, they'll come out with the official game, which is usually the same game, and then they add all this new content you can get. And, like, when World of Warcraft went in beta, a lot of people had their characters up to level 60. And then when the game, quote, came out, then it's like, okay, you actually now want to play it and continue playing your really good characters. You have to pay to play. And unlike in America, what a lot of people seem to be doing is getting their characters up to level 60 and then they stop playing the MMO. In Asia, they really play it to get up to 60, and then they start playing the MMO. It's almost the opposite way of thinking, is that they like to get their characters up right away. And that's almost like why Guild Wars does that, where you can actually start your character up at level 20 right away. You don't actually have to play levels 1 through 20 if you don't want to. And you can just get right into the meat and potatoes, which is sort of, you know, killing each other and doing combat and doing, you know, stuff like that. So EVE Online, back to that. Yeah, it's just weird. EVE Online, China now exceeds the population of Iceland, and it's it's a crazy game. If anyone's played EVE Online, I tried it out, and you either love this game or hate it. If you think like World of Warcraft is really light, or Guild Wars or any other MMO, give EVE Online a chance. And this is by far, this is work, okay? EVE Online is actually work. This is one of the toughest, craziest MMOs I've ever played in my entire existence on this planet. And you either just love this game or absolutely hate it. And one thing is that things take place in real time. So say you're going to actually be mining an asteroid. It'll say, okay, you're going to be mining the asteroid, and that'll be done in like 22 hours. And 22 hours is real life. So you go and, you know, come back next day, and then you finished what you were doing. And you could do multiple things, but it's pretty crazy, because then it's infectious. It sort of messes up your real life, and you have to almost adapt your real life schedule to the game schedule. And yeah, it was too much for someone like me who has a family and such. But, I know, like, Greg Canessa right now from Xbox Live, he's, like, really into that. He loves that game. But, give it a try if you're into something super hardcore and you're really bored with and need something to do. Okay, wow, I'm taking too long on news. Dragon's Lair goes HD. So, yeah, Digital Leisure, who's the guys who own Dragon's Lair, is bringing it back. As many of you know, it's one of my favorite, if not my favorite game of all time. I love Dragon's Lair, even though it's not really a game, blah, blah, blah. Get into a whole discussion on that. I love it anyhow. They're coming back. They're very excited. They're bringing it back to the PC in high definition, 5.1 surround sound. They're going to clean it up. That's the good news. The bad news, the price. It's going to be $60. $60. What the hell are they thinking? $60 for Dragon's Lair? I mean, I don't even know if this thing would even sell if it was like $30, to be honest. So $60, and I'm like the super hardcore world's biggest Dragon's Lair fan. You know, I'm the type of guy, I live in an apartment in Manhattan, as many of you know, and when I get a house, I am going to be looking for that Dragon's Lair. Of course, my wife doesn't know this, so don't let her anybody know. Don't tell her if anyone sees her, but I'm going to get a Dragon's Lair console case, and I'm going to be putting it into the garage or my office, which is probably going to be in the basement, as my wife often tells me, with all my other video game crap. But anyhow, I am going to be getting that Dragon's Lair cabinet and putting it in there, and oh my god, that's going to be so great. And I don't care what it costs. Actually, not that much. That guy, the guy who I stay with whenever I'm at GDC, he repairs and restores video game cabinets for a living, and has, or not for a living, for as a hobby. He's an electrical engineer as a living, and he's got like 40 of these things in his garage. I kid you not, it's crazy. He had like 4 sit-down Star Wars cabinets when I was last there, and he gets Dragon Lair, he gets Space Ace every so often. Yeah, but man, I'm gonna get that one day. But anyhow, $60? Jesus, that's a lot of money. I'm not getting it. Excuse me, it's just way too much. Crazy. Next up, it's like the MMO Newsweek. Of course, when is it not an MMO Newsweek? Blizzard and those MMO rumors. So I got a lot of emails from people this week, and there was a lot of emails, a lot of rumors flying that Blizzard is going to be making an MMO out of Diablo, and they're making an MMO out of StarCraft. They're going to go massively multiplayer, and that Vivendi has a model now to develop an MMO in 3 years for $50 million, and that the next Blizzard MMO is going to be coming out in 2009. Blah, blah, blah. Well, this is actually, this is crazy. So this original rumor is because there was an investment conference, and there was a slide that, it was this PowerPoint presentation by Vivendi that had this slide that actually listed Warcraft, Diablo, and StarCraft in 3 rows, and then it also had another chart next to it, said massively multiplayer online games, PC, Mac games, and console. And then it sort of filled in all the sections. So people can read that and sort of reinterpret the data, as you would call it. That's a fancy way. Reinterpret the data is a fancy way of saying that you take the data and adjust it to the way you want it to read, which people do all the time, unfortunately, is that it said that, you know, oh, it's going to be an MMO. Well, I'll tell you this. Vivendi doesn't decide. They do and they don't. Vivendi can say to Blizzard how they want them to actually do something, but Vivendi can come up with this whole model of making an MMO and making it say it's only $50 million, but they have absolutely zero ability. They have nothing to do with that. It's all Blizzard. Blizzard's the one who decided they were going to do an MMO. They're the ones who decide. They kind of call the shots on all of this. It's not Vivendi. Vivendi, although the parent company, they really have nothing to do with any of this, okay? They don't go in. They might fund it, but it's Blizzard the one who makes it. So, you know, this happens all the time. And I would, whenever you read something like this, always be careful, because it's often the parent companies have absolutely nothing to do, especially with creative divisions. You know, that's like saying the president of Sony is saying that they know how the next, you know, Grand Theft Auto game is going to be designed and created. You know, they don't, all right? They might, because that's not who makes the Grand Theft Auto game. It's Sony doesn't make it. Rockstar does. It's the same thing. Now, are those games going to come out in MMO form? As far as I know, and from everything I've heard from Blizzard, no, they're not. Not anytime soon. If they do, I would know about it. And there probably would be more whispers and rumors than you might think, because, like, World of Warcraft, a lot of people knew about that years before. I played it almost five years ago, or even more now. I actually played World of Warcraft. I was actually playing a paladin. I was the only one in the world. And, man, the game was horribly unbalanced. I couldn't even get past level 7. It was so ridiculously hard fighting the creatures. It was you know, the game was really, you know, it's been in works a long time, and a lot of these MMOs you hear about, and everyone knows, like when Half-Life 2 was being developed, everyone knew in the industry that Half-Life 2 was being developed, and although it was a big surprise for most people, it really wasn't that big a surprise for everyone else. So I'll try to find out more about this. I know for a fact they're working on StarCraft, the next StarCraft. I know for a fact they're working on the next Diablo. But it is Blizzard. They can make Diablo 2, Diablo 3, and finish it and throw it away after it's done. They can play it and say, you know what, this game stinks. And they're never going to release it. And they've done it. I mean, they did that with Ghost twice already. I mean, they finished the game and threw it away because it just wasn't good and it was not going to help them. I mean, you know, they make so much money in World of Warcraft, all it would do is hurt them. They could release the game, it wouldn't get that great reviews, and forever they would have a black eye and it wouldn't make them that much money. So there's no point. They just threw it away and just called it a day. So, you know, if they are going to release something like this, they're going to take their time and it's going to be amazing and they're going to really, you know, go for broke. But I have a feeling that, you know, time, it'll be telling when they release the Burning Crusade. After Burning Crusade comes out, you know, then they've sort of gone through the cycle. Are they going to continue? They're going to always continuously update World of Warcraft, but are they going to make a new game? Are they going to, you know, try to redo a franchise? Are they going to make an MMO out of one of their old ones? I don't really know. And a lot of people, even at Blizzard, they're not 100% sure from what I know from when I talk to those guys. So they're still kind of figuring it out because they just make so much money on World of Warcraft. I mean, it's just making nothing. It just makes money. I mean, it makes hundreds of millions and billions. You know, it's making over $1 billion now. So, you know, it's hard for them to justify other things at this point. DS Lite sells 136,000 units in 2 days. And so the first 2 days on the market sold 136,000 units. It's on pace to match the original DS figures, which sold 500,000 units in its first 10 days. So I'm going to review it later, but the DS Lite is incredible. It really is amazing. Next, Double Fine demands a 360 compatible version of Psychonauts. So, yeah, there's been a lot of news recently because the 360, Peter Moore said that he wasn't going to, you know, he doesn't really care too much about the backwards compatibility and they're going to stop doing it soon. And I'm wondering about that because almost every single game I have doesn't work on the 360 from the original Xbox. And Psychonauts, which was my game of the year, it doesn't work as well. And, you know, the thing is that I could see where they're coming from. You know, Tim Schafer from the guy who made Psychonauts, and they want it so that, you know, next generation people can buy it. But, you know, the problem is that a lot of more people have Xboxes then have 360s. So it's not like that's going to magically enhance the sales if suddenly you can play this on the 360. I think it's just a good way of getting some press. But there were some new games that were added to the list of backwards compatible games. And I'm going to talk about this later because someone asked a question about this. But like games like Big Mother Truckers, Bad Boys 2, Minority Report, like all these crappy games get added to the backwards compatibility list. And, well, you know what? I'm not going to spoil it. There's a very good reason why you're seeing crap getting added to the backwards compatibility list. And I call it crap because these are not great games. I mean, Bad Boys 2, got, actually, I think Tommy Tallarico really liked that game in his TV show. But Minority Report, you know, these aren't the greatest games. And yet they're all getting backwards compatibility. Well, there's reasons why, like Barbie games, things like that. But I'll talk about that later. But I do find it amusing that Tim Schafer said, he writes, I want you to send Microsoft a heartfelt message, something to the effect of, I'm a 9-year-old boy in the hospital dying of consumption, and my last wish is to play Psychonauts on my Xbox 360s. Please try to make up your own disease. I guess that's kind of funny. It's kind of sick and sad, too, so don't get me wrong. I'm not someone who condones that sort of stuff, but if taken in a humorous way, it is funny. Yeah, Psychonauts, man. If you haven't played that game, go buy it. Seriously. I mean, I'm still playing that game. That game is so freaking good. And if you have a PC and you don't have it, get a PC and get a 360 controller. Plug it in. It works awesome. I'm actually using my 360 wired controller on my PC. It's great. And buy it. It's such a freaking good game. Spore. Hey, Spore is coming out on mobile phones. It has been confirmed. I actually said that it was coming out on mobile phones at GDC, and then I had to retract it because that was not confirmed, but now it has been confirmed. No big surprise. EB's Mobile Vice Senior Vice President Mitch Lasky said, titles like Medal of Honor, SOCOM, Battlefield, Spore, Need for Speed are in the pipeline. Yeah, no kidding. Spore is going to come out for everything. You know, it's going to come out for the DS. It's already been confirmed. It's going to come out for the PSP. It's going to come out with a cell phone. It's going to come out. There's going to be everything. There's going to be the Spore video game. There's going to be Spore, kids meal at McDonald's. There's going to be Spore Matchbox covers. There's going to be Spore board games. Okay, they're gonna milk this thing to death. I mean, the few people I've been talking about at EA, I mean, they know that this is going to be like the biggest push of all time for them. This is going to be like the end all be all because they don't have any more Lord of the Rings coming out. You know, they have some games, but there's no more movies. Harry Potter is here and there. You know, they still got Harry Potter, but Lord of the Rings was really their big push. So they're gonna be pimping Spore like there's no tomorrow, and it's going to come out for everything you've ever heard of. They're going to have Spore for the Atari 2600. I mean, you name it, it's coming out for it. I wouldn't worry too much. Let's see. Lara Croft is actually getting a 10th anniversary edition of Tomb Raider. They're coming out with a 10th anniversary Eidos for the PS2, the PSP, and the PC. It looks like they're going to take the original Tomb Raider and redo it somehow. They don't have any details here. Like, maybe they're going to redo the graphics, maybe they're going to enhance it. I don't know. You know, the first Tomb Raider had fantastic level design, really amazing level design. And people say, you know, that game was very popular, first Tomb Raider, because, you know, it had Lara Croft and, you know, she had like big boobs and all that. And, you know, it was also one of the first true 3D games. But, you know, it was a good game. It was simple as that. It had all of that, but it also had really good gameplay. It had really great level design. I haven't played it in 10 years, so it's hard for me to say if it's standard the test of time. So I really want to give this one a go and see if the game is going to be as good as I remember it. Because I looked at actually reinstalling the original Tomb Raider, but it's painful. It's funny. I've been reading a lot of people who've been doing kind of retrospects of the PS1, PlayStation 1 games, and they all say the same thing. They said, what were we thinking? These graphics are terrible. And they're right. I mean, the funny thing is I kind of knew that at the time. I never really played the PS1 that much. I played really Nintendo a heck of a lot more, and the PC games a heck of a lot more than PS1 games. My PS1 library is actually pretty light compared to my Nintendo 64 library and my Game Boy library for that matter, and definitely the PC library just crushes them all. But yeah, there's no release date or pricing information, so that's all we know for now. And then finally, we have a report here that Microsoft is working on a handheld. The New York Post and Reuters reported that Robbie Bach, who is previously oversaw the Xbox division of Microsoft, is apparently working on a new project in the company. It's supposedly this mythological iPod killer. It's long been rumored, blah, blah, blah. Let's see. You know, I will tell you a little tidbit. I interviewed Shane Kim a few weeks ago at E3, and I was talking to him, and I mentioned something about, you know, a podcast. And even when I said, you know, oh, I do a podcast, and even that, he cringed. And he's like, said, well, we don't like that word. So, they didn't even just like the word podcast. And everyone at Microsoft was calling them, oh, what were they calling them? They don't call them podcasts. They call them like game casts or media casts. They call them something slightly different. But it just goes to show you, you know, like they're very much aware of this. So they, you know, they definitely want to somehow kill or hurt iPod in some way. And this was like, I actually worked with Pepsi once on a big project. We did this pretty cool thing with them. And I went to their headquarters, which is right here in upstate New York, right near me. And I remember everywhere you looked, everything was Pepsi. Pepsi, Pepsi. Everything was in that Pepsi font, which actually is a really ugly font if you have regular signs, because it's like this futuristic font. It looks terrible for, like, you know, like it says men's room or please don't throw your trash. Oh, horrible font. But everything's in that font. Pepsi's everywhere. All the colors are the color of Pepsi, so it's all like blue everywhere. There's no red, which is the color of Coke. And, you know, and even in their meetings, they never mention Coke. They always use some like euphemism, and they would always say that other brand, and everyone knew what they were talking about. They would call it the other. And I remember they even said like how they made money, because I was doing this thing with them, and they said to me at this meeting, they said, you know, Steve, the way we make money is branding and image, because our sugar water isn't that much different than the other company's sugar water, and the only difference is image. And I still think about that to this day. And speaking of that, actually, another funny story, which has nothing to do with gaming. I was doing this gaming website for Tag Heuer watches. And I remember I did this presentation to them, and this was like the CEO of Tag Heuer US. And he was like laughing about something we did on the game. And he said, and it had pricing information for all the watches. And he said, you know, Steve, it's like, you know, they pay $50 for the watch mechanics and $950 for that little Tag Heuer logo. So, you know, anyhow, this outcome, I have this jaded, or not jaded, but I would say very serious business view on everything that I look at, because this is what they think of. This is what these guys do. I mean, it's not, you think these are companies that are here to like make games and really like, you know, make everyone happy. They're here to make money. Okay. They're here to make money. That's what these companies do. Well, speaking of money, let's go to Microsoft. Yay. Who actually did great. They flew me out, got to meet Peter Moore yet again, and Lewis Castle for the very first time. Huge fan of Westwood. I've played every Command & Conquer. He and I had an awesome time. But let's get into my roundtable interview with Peter Moore.
Interview!
So I've sat down with Peter Moore twice before. I sat down with him at GDC, and I sat down with him at E3. And at both times, it was a roundtable. I didn't get a chance to do a one-on-one with him. And I didn't actually post those. And the reason is because they weren't all that great, in my opinion. They were very sort of canned. And, you know, he was at these events to really push, you know, these agendas. And you know what? That's what they do. And that's fine. Okay, that's actually, I don't fault Peter for that. But, you know, he was really pushing and being very, very directed with his comments. But then when we met him, he was really relaxed. He was like in jeans and a, you know, shirt. He was like in his environment, in his own office. And this is actually a really great interview. So I'm definitely posting this one. It actually isn't just me. This was me and a whole bunch of guys. It was actually everyone who attended the event. There's like Chris from DreamStation CC is there. Godfrey's there. So a whole bunch of guys you probably have heard of who also do podcasts. No, those guys are great guys. Actually, the guys at DreamStation CC, Chris and Chris, I had a great time with them. I actually was talking to, there's two Chris's, and the other Chris who runs DreamStation, I was hanging out with at E3 with him and his family, and couldn't be a nicer guy. And then Godfrey is like from Florida, and he's a funny dude, man. He was great. I really enjoyed hanging out with him. Everyone there was super nice. But here's this interview with Peter Moore, his actual title, Corporate Vice President of Microsoft Interactive Entertainment Business in the Entertainment and Devices Division. Wow, that is long, okay? Barely fits on a business card. You almost need two sides for that thing. But he talks about, well, he talks about a whole bunch of cool things. He actually really opens up, gives you some inside dirt. And it was great. Probably the best interview I've ever heard from Peter Moore. So let's listen.
I saw you piling out of your luxury limos this morning as I was cranking out my work here. That's right, we're going to talk about Middle Earth.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I've only got about 25 minutes, and I can ramble on, as you probably know, but what I'd love to do is with, I know we're doing some podcasting, and I'd love to take questions, and first of all, give you a formal welcome. It's always great to have the support of the community members here, and particularly in the presence of Major Nelson, which is always... Which is always a thrill for me.
You're looking skinny. Are you losing weight, Barry?
I am. You're running me ragged.
Is that what it is? Doesn't he look good? I mean, are you deliberately trying to lose?
Yeah,
good for you.
Thank you.
And you're so
you
happy
well
that... thank you. We have this mutual admiration society. Are you working out or are you
gym a couple times a week.
My.
Are you?
Jim?
You know...
Jim might do the same thing.
Jim will do it.
Well, I'm getting ready so
I work out 4 times a week at 6 a.m. with a trainer.
Really?
When you're as old as I am, it's the only way you can maintain any level of status quo.
And what's her name?
Her name's Katie Yang. She's a Texas Longhorn. She's a former cheerleader.
I think I need to get her name. We'll
yeah, that's fine. Anyway, welcome. I'd love to take any questions. Let's make this very interactive. And literally, I got a hard stop at 9:30.
Just real quickly, I just wanted everybody, all the community guys, to just kind of introduce themselves.
Yeah, I've met many of you, whether it's E3 or GDC, I think I met a few people as well. But yeah, if you want to just...
Well, I'll kick off. I'm Lou Castle with Electronic Arts and the executive producer for the game.
You are a legend, sir.
Okay. In my own mind, anyways.
In your own shower.
Godfrey from GamerTagRadio.com.
Good to see you again. Styling with your lid. I love the lid.
Chris Palladino from GameStation.cc podcasting.
Cool.
Hey, Steve Glicker from Gaming Steve.
Yeah.
A couple times.
GDC, San Jose, last time.
Yeah.
Craig Matthews and Xbox.com.
He's our new videographer.
Really? That's a... Do we have the budget for that camera?
Has
Jay pay for that?
Yeah.
What's Jay doing nowadays?
I don't know.
No idea.
I've seen him in a couple weeks.
I'm Raj Joshi. I'm a producer on this title.
Yep.
Arctic Aurora, Nathan Kramer, real life, and it's gamereplays.org, so strategies, replays, you name it, community stuff.
Cool.
I'm
Amrit Zlay, a product manager on Battlefield the Loaded 2.
I'm Kestra from Heaven Games.
I'm Mike, aka Kula, editor for Xbox
360. AKA what?
Kula, COOLA.
Kula. I need an AKA.
Yeah.
I'm Jason Ferguson, I'm here from Strategy Informer.
Jason.
Matt Gerlach, I'm an MVP. On the
forums
as well.
And I'm Aaron Apoc Kaufman. I'm the official community manager on the title and also Command & Conquer as well. So
great.
So
what's
together.
Apoc mean again?
It's AKA.
I'm trying to get out of here. It's not going to happen to you, I promise.
Excellent.
All right, fire away.
I have to ask, what is the tattoos rule? I have to get that out of the way.
You know, I'm actually, you know what I suddenly realized? I'm wearing my E3 shirt. This is the shirt I had when to do that. But I'm not pulling my sleeves up. You know, it's, if you've been married as, if you, the guns are there. When you've been married as long as I have, coming home with tattoos unannounced is not a way. I will have been married 25 years in about 6 months and not a way to stay married, tattooing your arms with video games. Because it's dated material as well, you know, it's difficult to do anything. So we'll move on from that question.
In keeping with the idea of interface being kind of key to our game, I was thinking about what your take is on emerging technologies such as tabletop, touchscreens, iToys, even the Wii controller, things of that nature. Where are we moving as far as interface goes and interactivity?
Interface is very important, particularly, you know, in our goal to broaden, let's talk about games per se, and as I've been well documented, I'm a huge fan, and I got to play with the Wii controller with Sonic and with Super Monkey Ball, my old friends. The only place I thought they'd let me go was next door to Sega and play in a room there, and I had a great deal of fun. Super Monkey Ball was, I don't know if you got to, it was tough because it was, I did the track and field one, and I was tired after about 2 minutes going like this. But Sonic almost felt like it was a game built for the controller because it was very intuitive, and obviously the way you play Sonic, you're going through in motion and speed, and I found the controller very intuitive. It's going to, for me, I had all of like 4 minutes on each game, is how thin that's going to wear after half an hour, and that was my biggest challenge. And it felt like... it felt like it's going to be a party console, if you will. And nothing wrong with that at all. And, of course, it occurred to me, and the first interview I did afterwards said, boy, I can just see buying an Xbox 360 and a Wii, and that commentary took on a life of its own as well. And I still have some change in your pocket from the other thing. So from that point of view, I've always been a huge fan of innovation. We're doing a lot of stuff here at looking at the way that people interface with technology. Not so much here, actually, in the Xbox, but broadly in Microsoft. In particular, we have this thing called MSR, which are almost skunkworks for technology. We're in Cambridge, Larry. There's one in
Beijing,
where we have some of the world's best and brightest. And we're fortunate we've got a couple of dollars in the bank where we can say, go figure out what problems we can solve with technology. And we have incredibly smart people working on stuff. Tabletop stuff where you just touch, the way that you can interact with technology around the home, in the kitchen. You know, if somebody could provide for me something to keep my family organized, calendars where you simply touch in and it's built into the granite countertop or whatever, that's the kind of stuff that I really think is going to make our lives better. Any way that we can play and make games easier and more intuitive that takes the intimidation factor away from what is a pretty complex device now when you look at the controller. Shoulder buttons, triggers, analog sticks, D-pads, I mean, there's a lot going on there. You compare it to the old Atari 2600 button and stick, which everybody could pick up and have some fun with. Clearly, I think the Wii is trying to get back to those days, although when I picked it up, I was surprised how much stuff there is on there. And it took me a little while even then to get going on those things. So I'm a huge fan of any kind of innovation you can try and do that will make it a broader reach for games. Because, you know, as an industry, we've got to do that. We've got to bring more people in that are currently maybe intimidated by when they look at that controller. And I look, even in my house, I look at it, there's no way that my 14-year-old daughter can really grasp. She loves to play racing games, but that's about it. And she's frustrated because the button configurations and the use of the triggers, she just doesn't quite get it. So we're doing a lot of stuff there, nothing that we're ready to talk about, and we're not going to force anything that is not going to be intuitive and innovative.
Well, I invite you and your daughter to try and play our game. It's much like the Atari 2600. All you need is a stick and a button.
One button to rule them all.
That's it. Well, when you think of games like RTSs, they're perfect there because you know, the ability for you to look at things, then make a decision that there's no pressure and it's not fast twitch. And I think that certainly she's tried. She actually was playing Oblivion. And the pacing of that is pretty cool as well and allows her to go through. And it's just a gorgeous game. And obviously it's selling very, very well. She's a PGR player. She does once she gets on the straightaway, it's really just this. And she loves that, and she loves watching spectator mode. She actually enjoys. She's a voyeur more than a player. Sit and watch.
That game's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous game. Okay, fire away, you guys. Don't be shy.
You guys were talking an awful lot about user-created content.
Yeah.
The whole Velocity Girl thing. And
I remember her.
Right. So you came out and said this is going to be something that's coming in the future. Do you have any ballpark? I mean, we're talking
future.
Months, years.
Future's right. Still sticking by that commentary. I mean, the idea was we needed to get the marketplace infrastructure built out, get MS points up and running, which we do. I don't know if you saw our announcement, but the billionth point was used. Was it the Friday after E3?
Yep.
And that, you know, getting the complexity of a microtransaction system up and running on a global basis is not trivial work. We've done that, and now the next thing is providing tools, and we're still planning to do that. Nothing that I can put a date on right now. Our priority as well, getting, which has been obviously very well received, this latest live update done, which was very important. A lot of people working on huge list of updates to the live interface. And once we get through that, then the teams roll on to other things. But yeah, absolutely. The ability for you to go in and do user-created content. We're looking at this, the world of digital objects and this economy. We've all read about Second Life, obviously, and the things that are going on there. Plus, we're looking at Asia right now. And previously, people like Shanda and NetEase that do these massively multiplayer games that charge you subscription are now moving to trying to bring more people in, such as we're talking about innovation. And instead of being subscription-based, finding games now that are digital object-based. In other words, trying to find a different business model than subscription, which is never easy to keep people hooked month after month after month, I guess unless you're World of Warcraft, where it seems very easy. But saying, you know, if you want to play the game, here's your basic game, but you really want to enjoy the game, you buy these digital objects. And really shifting the economy of the game to a different level and putting it in the hands of the users, how much money they want to spend. But yeah, there will come a time when we will have user-created content, digital objects. It'll all be powered out of the marketplace engine and Microsoft Points being the currency, the virtual currency behind that.
I mean, I know all of us podcasters, we're waiting for the day that we can go and stick our show on there, whether we charge or not, to have the content that everybody can freely get. I mean, what you guys did at E3 with the videos and everything, very, very good job.
Yeah, that was a lot of pain because it was something we decided to do maybe a month before and said, this is what we're going to do, and Xbox.com guys are great in getting in there. We had to upload this stuff in real time, prep it, it's all high definition, get it up on the servers around the world and deliver it. It wasn't easy to do. And things like the Lost Planet demo have been phenomenal. And then, of course, being able to stick Halo 3 up there in real time was huge as well. And even Gears of War cinematic trailer.
If anybody would want their podcast up there, I mean, I would. I sit on the team that makes the codes.
I didn't say that. We were trying to
Larry hasn't offered us the right deal yet. Well, let's
slip in there.
Once he has a deal that we're happy with, we might talk to him.
What do you think about the Xbox 360 being, you know, the first console to really bring a true RTS to the console?
Well, we talk about this. I mean, certainly when we think of Microsoft Game Studios and the work we've done over the years in RTS, we're a huge fan of that stuff. It's an interesting genre in that when I look at the future of what our industry is about, RTSs are things that you can point out very proudly about the game style, the game mechanics, what you do. I always hate to use the word educational, but RTSs allow you have to make decisions. They're competitive yet collaborative, and it's always been a problem on the console, obviously, for the style of gameplay and what people typically look for in a console. An RTS is whether it's too slow or is it, you know, the home, you know, was built for the PC. Built for utilization of a keyboard and mouse, but really when I look at and we're very excited about this because this will be the first true RTS that will come to the console, but I also look at what we can do with our, we have two or three real strong franchises and real-time strategy games that we need to look, and we haven't done our job right yet because we haven't figured out how to bring them over. We're very happy over the years of what we've been able to do in this space, but we're excited about a title like this, and I think if it does what Halo did, I mean, you know, I don't mind comparing it to Halo, but you think about FPSs 5-6 years ago, nobody dreamt you'd bring them to the console. And it was until a talented studio like Bungie was able to figure out how the game mechanic needed to work and what really would work, getting away from the keyboard and the mouse and bringing it over to utilize with the game control. And I think this has the potential, and of course, what incredible intellectual property to be able to use to get behind it as well, you know. So, and then nobody better than EA to be able to put the wood behind it, which is very, very important. I mean, it's a risk. I mean, you're trying to redefine what console play is all about. But boy, we couldn't be more excited about this.
Yeah, we're hoping a lot of people go and smash their keyboards and.
Well, you know, we are at Microsoft, so smashing keyboards, there's a balance we like to do. I mean,
okay, like Dell keyboards or whatever.
Anything that connects to a computer is all right in our eyes. But you think about what we showed at E3 and the concept of live anywhere and cross-platform play, and RTSs, you think in the future years what you can do if you blur the lines between a console and a PC, and you find ways for making which we're doing obviously with the common controller, but making that input to the game, regardless whether you're looking at it on a PC and looking at it on your Xbox 360, an RTS is the perfect genre for doing some of that. So.
I had a question going back to the E3 topic. During the MTV Road to Years of War, it felt like you didn't like the chainsaw. I was just curious
what you were seeing was obviously an edited program, and just so you all know, I love the chainsaw. What we were actually discussing is where the chainsaw fit in. There was a cinematic trailer, then there was a live demo. And my commentary actually, although it was taken a little bit out of context when you were listening to what Laura was saying, Peter Moore doesn't like the chainsaw. Yeah, oh my God. What it was is I wanted the chainsaw to come at the end of the demo. We actually looked at the demo, and when the demo was first presented to me when I saw it, which is only 2 weeks before E3, you could see from the show things were coming in real hot towards the week before E3. The chainsaw, as Marcus broke out of jail, the chainsaw was being used almost immediately in that first courtyard. And I thought the chainsaw was, you know, the money shot. And from the point of view of you wait for it to come in the final battle to get to the helicopter, that's when I said the chainsaw should be used. So it was a little taken out of context, and maybe for the program it sounded more dramatic that I decided I didn't like the chainsaw.
Yeah,
to be clear, I love the chainsaw.
Okay.
Right? It's just where it was. And in the cinematic trailer as well, I didn't want the chainsaw to be given away because there was we were putting, literally, I was getting too involved in this, clearly, because I was actually looking at how we build the cinematic trailer, which is how we launched the press briefing, and then it was Cliffy B, and then he did the full demo. I didn't want the chainsaw to be in the trailer because I wanted the drama of the chainsaw to be right at the end of the courtyard where Marcus Fenix and Dom had blasted their way through, I don't remember in the demo, and then they're fighting their way to the helicopter, and then they've got four or five drones between them and the helicopter. I thought the chainsaw moment, and, you know, it worked out perfectly, was there, and people, I was in the crowd because I actually sat in the audience and then walked to the front when the demo was over. And people didn't know I was there. I was just sat by about six guys, and they go, "Oh yeah!" And just, they had not seen it before, and I thought the chainsaw moment was spectacular. So yeah, don't. I mean, I thought the show was pretty good, except it kind of took what my concerns. I was concerned, but concerned differently for what the show purported. I was not concerned about the chainsaw. Mm. Just where the chainsaw fit in. I thought there was a dramatic moment that had to be there.
Yeah, everyone's like, "Why doesn't he like the chainsaw?"
Oh, yeah,
that's
yeah.
The whole point.
Can we ask a little bit harder question?
Maybe? Sure.
So what's going on with Japan, and what are our short-term outlooks for what we're trying to do in Japan to get that?
Well, there's never been short-term outlooks because it's a long-term investment. And, you know, as I said at E3, we actually saw a latest build of Blue Dragon, which is going to be phenomenal for us. And then Lost Odyssey coming along. I mean, it's really, our progress will be pinned against those two titles. I've said it many, many times. As well as 99 Nights did recently. It's all about driving towards what Sakaguchi's doing. And until we get real Japanese-developed, for Japanese gamers RPGs in the market, we'll never know whether we can really make the progress we need to in that marketplace. But, you know, it's also Sony coming in with a PlayStation 3 at 59,000 yen. It's going to be very interesting. And I think what's going to happen is you're going to see a lot more balance. I saw, as I'm sure you guys saw, the Famitsu research that shows the excitement around Wii. And, you know, GameCube has done okay to poorly in Japan, maybe getting 12 to 14% market share. I can see them making tremendous progress, depending on their pricing they come out with, because Japan is still a very much price-sensitive market. Even though the economy's improving now, we've seen 5-6 years of declines in pure console play. A lot of it's moving to the mobile space, and the DS is doing phenomenally well. Much to the chagrin of Sony with the PSP, and that there's only so many dollars in a young consumer's pocket, or so many yen, and you know, the console's been hurt by that. But I think stuff that we're doing in Xbox Live, and in particular doing a lot more in arcade in recent weeks, to be able to localize Japanese games, and I think that could be the key to driving a lot more success.
Do you think without the success in Japan, can you still call the console a success, even if it does amazing in the States without that Japanese support?
Well, Japan's very important, and it's important at so many levels. But this is a global economy. I mean, for every Japan you have right now, of course, we announced 9 new countries coming on board. This will be the generation where we really globalize our business. I mean, we're finding out ways to protect our intellectual property in countries like China. We're going to go into South Africa, we're going into India. I mean, who'd have thunk it? I mean, going in there, as economies develop, and particularly India, which has got some very strong middle-class pockets, going in there and finally having a formal distribution system other than the gray market, which has previously existed, and going in there into markets where they can afford to pay, because there's a very strong middle class growing up now. The concept, and very, very interested in gaming. You've got a lot of computer science graduates coming out. Obviously, outsourcing is really invigorating.
That's touchy now. I'm a programmer, so.
You'll look by the wall.
It's in my future,
I think. Yeah. Nice. I think that the ability for us to be able to grow the marketplace in place, because really we only ever focused on Japan, US, Canada is a little bit of an adjunct to it, and Europe. You know, Canada is starting to grow. China, we never knew what to do there because you only ship them one disk and they'll take care of the rest. Yeah. But online helps enormously now to authenticate and validate, the actual hardware and the actual software being legitimate. I think the Beijing Olympics is making the Chinese government really focus on what its persona to the outside world is going to be as regards making sure that copyright owners have their protections in place. And I think that we're going to see some great growth in emerging markets. We're opening up Eastern Europe this time around, as those countries join the European Union. You're now getting formal retail in there, and it's starting to really, places like Poland and Romania, Hungary, these countries are all coming online as part of the European Union, and so you've got euro there as a basis of currency, and you're also getting some retail chains building up in specialty business. So Japan is important, continues to be important, but you could probably say that one country now in an economy of literally hundreds now is not going to make a break where you're at. But boy, we're going to keep plugging away there.
So when are we going to see Street Fighter on Xbox Live, Ricky?
I don't know the date. It's coming. I think I announced that at CES.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know, Larry, whether there's a date been announced.
There hasn't been a date
announced. No. It's maybe close. A question.
It's yeah. close.
It's,
I know that.
Yeah.
It's been pretty exciting. I think it's pretty exciting to release a console, and not a lot of people have had a hand in that, and now this is your second, correct, Dreamcast being the first.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what kind of key learnings were you able to leverage in releasing...
Don't launch consoles. No, first of all, the Dreamcast, I have never met anybody, and somebody last night recognized me somewhere, and I was in London this week. And I realized that I had an old suitcase and still had my Sega business card attached to it. And it was the guy that was showing me to my room and said, "Oh, you work for Sega? Oh, man, I got a Dreamcast." And this is just a young English kid, 19 years of age, who was like a bellboy. And for 10 minutes, talked to me about a game I'd forgotten about, Toy Commander. I don't know if everybody remembers Toy Commander. And, we talked about Toy Commander, Trick Style, obviously Soul Calibur, Hydro Thunder, Power Stone for those 2D scrolling fighter game. And, just talked about how great the Dreamcast was. And as disappointing as it all turned out, whether you bought it at $199 or whether you bought it at $49 at Toys R Us when it was all over, I have never met anybody that's ever been disappointed that they bought a Dreamcast. And still to this day will pull out, primarily for Soul Calibur and Sonic Adventure as well.
Shenmue.
My best Shenmue story would be coming back post 9/11 from the UK with my wife and kids, and there was a time where you had to show your passport before you even went near security. There was a secondary, there was a filtering before you got there, and we had just done Shenmue, came over to the Xbox, I don't remember
right.
that
oh, yeah.
that time. And guy was TSA security, saw me coming. I was in the O'Hare, just wandering, just me wandering through there. And he says, "I don't need to see your passport. You're the asshole that gave away Shenmue to Xbox." I will never. My wife looks at me and says, "What is it you do?" And that was, people, there is a pocket of people about Shenmue that there are very vocal, maybe 4,000 or 5,000 of them, but just live and die for that game. And I still, it was a game Sega put a lot of money behind. And but there was something that just didn't quite gel to make it a mass market game. It was a shame. But from the Dreamcast, lessons learned. I always like to think that the ability to go online rests firmly and squarely at that little 28K modem we had at the back of the Dreamcast. And Greg Thomas and the boys of Visual Concepts doing NFL 2K and NBA 2K. And you had a pretty decent gaming experience at 28K through your telephone line. And then, of course, we did the broadband adapter. And that allowed you to play Quake 3, I would have been at that time, I think. First time you went broadband and played. But console launches are incredibly exciting things. But, boy, you have no idea the work that goes on to get where you need to be, particularly when you decide, hey, why don't we do this globally and do it all in 18 days? You file that one that seemed like a good idea at the time. The work that goes into to bring those titles in when you're working with new hardware and you get in the alpha kits and then the beta kits and then final hardware comes in just a few months before, and development studios are trying to get their hands around it, and you still needed to push out 18 titles on day one, all finished and polished, localized for the world, and do all your localization and the software and the platform itself, and finish all the design work and get it cranked out there. You know, it was an incredibly, I'd say, cathartic experience of having get it done, and then, you know, you then worry about your attach rate for the first 2 weeks. I mean, it's been great for us, but all of the work, and then you see people are exhausted here. I can tell you on this campus, and Larry will bear me out here, in the months September and October, we were 24/7. Pizza was flying in here at 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night, and I'm sure it was the same in Liverpool, Bizarre Creations, and then Twycross at Rare, where everybody wanted to get those games done and finished, and things were changing in real time as we were finding out things with the hardware, getting the marketing plans done, making sure all our TV work, all the brand work we did, jump rope and water balloons, all those, we had to go, jump rope was filmed, I was in New York, and water balloons was filmed in Buenos Aires, and getting all of that done, getting it localized. There are 1,000 moving parts that have to come together. So when you hit November 22nd or November 21st at 12:01, and I'm with Bill over in Bellevue Best Buy, and I'll never forget the guy, who was the first guy in line. I don't know if you came over that night, but, and it was pouring with rain. There's a change. And and Bill gave this, and this guy's look of sheer delight on his face. Because he was a Microsoft employee. For some reason, who lined up for like 26 hours.
Yeah.
Well, I hope he took a vacation day. We checked.
Yeah.
But that was a great night. 0 Hour was just unbelievable. Something we'll never forget. I shall never forget those big doors coming open and seeing the crowd. Jay and I were on this little podium, and we could actually take the look of the. So there's like 3,000-4,000 people there as the huge hangar doors opened. So the light comes on these people, and they were like, you ever seen your kids on Christmas morning? They walk in there and see the gifts, and just. The sheer look of delight, and then they all ran like kids in the forest, and thinking that they only had like 30 minutes to do this, forgetting that they had full 24 hours of gameplay, and then just walking around there 3-4 hours into it, watching people nestling into their beanbags and playing the games. That was just a phenomenal experience. So yeah, I mean, a lot of lessons learned. You know, you'd do it, of course you'd do it all again, but they were very different launches as well. And both of them were things I'll never forget.
So how is the Halo movie coming along?
So Jackson, we're yet to announce a director, but certainly we announced Peter Jackson as the executive producer. I don't know a lot more about where it's at. It's Universal Studios announcements to make. Universal and then Fox is the distributing company. We obviously own the intellectual property, but we're not making a movie. Not what we do. We make games.
Could you try to suggest Ridley Scott, possibly?
I love Ridley Scott. You know, you think of Ridley Scott with Aliens and Gladiator and... you know, but yeah. If he could do it like the second Aliens, right. that sense of horror and yet action that he had there. One of my favorite movies of all time. And, you know, and Ridley's a Brit, so we'd speak the same language and the whole thing, but... I don't know. It's not our call. What happens is you create intellectual property. We actually did the screenplay as the basis, and whoever the director is will probably polish that a little bit. But once you give it to the studios, they become in control, certainly from the movie point of view. We'll have a lot of creative control and collaboration, as we've said many times, but it's their movie. We're not in the business of making movies.
So it's going to be like, you know, real actors, not CGI?
Don't know.
Oh, okay.
Don't know.
We did.
Okay, I'll take one more question, because I have to go.
Okay.
There you go.
I'm a big fan of RTS games like Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
Also, big fan of RPGs. That's my favorite genre.
Mm-hmm.
And as we said earlier, RTS consoles are always pretty dry when it comes to RTS, but neither the Xbox or the 360 are really that big on RPGs either. So what kind of plans...
Well, I'd like to think Oblivion's not a bad game.
Oblivion's great.
Yeah.
Knights of the Republic on Xbox was great.
Yep.
But the actual amount... of RPGs isn't that great, especially when you compare it to like the PlayStation. There's hordes of them. What kind of plans do you guys have that would help you bring more games of both of these genres to the Xbox?
Well, particularly in RPG, hordes is not necessarily a good word, because I think there are RPGs. One thing I've always hated about RPGs, if it's investing 10 hours and realizing it's not exactly what I wanted to play, but you have to get so deep into it. I don't know, we're pretty happy with Fable. I thought it was 2 million and selling, and then you know, obviously we've now acquired Lionhead, so there's a belief in a studio and somebody like Peter Molyneux that can drive that RPG experience that is very unique. We talked about both Blue Dragon and Lost Odyssey, which will come globally, and those will be that classic Japanese style of RPGs, which quite frankly is the predominance of RPGs you see on the Sony platform. And then having, you know, we had Morrowind in the first go around. Obviously, Oblivion is somewhat of a sequel to that, not necessarily from the same storyline. And you've got to think that we can continue to do that. There's many, many years to go on the Xbox 360, and I hope the team at Bethesda would continue to do, you know, focus on this incredible franchise they seem to have built on the Xbox platform. And there's a few more RPGs we're looking at that we can't announce right now. You know, we have announced a Marvel MMORPG, and we'll be talking a little bit more about that in the summer, about more details about that. And there are some RPGs we're looking at, but our focus is always about quality, particularly in the world of RPG. The action-adventure games you pick up, and you know pretty much in 5 minutes whether it's something you want to invest time in. RPGs, you really got to get into it and really, you know, dive into the storyline, figure out whether you like the characters. And it's only after many, many hours of play you figure out, am I into this or not? So our focus on quality titles like this in particular, where you think of RTSs and RPGs, which suck you in and get you involved, you know, it's going to be a focus on quality, not quantity. And we've talked a lot about, in particular at Microsoft Game Studios, about focusing on less games but bigger games. And you think of the lineup right now, you know, for the next 6, 8, 10 months of Crackdown 2, Human, Mass Effect, Viva Pinata, Forza 2, little thing called Gears of War, and then sometime next year, Halo 3. You know, it's not a bad lineup of stuff. RPGs need to be, I think, a key focus point for us in, I was about to say fiscal year, but that means not to you, late calendar 07, calendar 08, and see where we're at there. There are a lot of third parties now working on role-playing games that we're excited about. But again, I think it's got to be about quality. So, hordes, not sure we'll get hordes, but great RPGs that really make a difference and drive the platform, absolutely. That's what we're looking at.
Peter, what's going on with Jay? He's not been around.
Jay is.
He's around.
Yeah, Jay is right across the street there.
Yeah.
Jay is, you know, the live update we're all enjoying. That's Jay's team. You know, this little thing called Xbox Live just doesn't, you know, work on its own. There are hundreds of people who all report into Jay from a platform development point of view. And any platform dev we do on this and going forward, and you know, eventually we should probably start working on the next one. You know, and that'll be Jay. I mean, we don't make them and then ship them the next year. These things take years to develop, and that will be Jay's responsibility as well. So all platform development, whether it's live or the console itself, reports into Jay, and that's hundreds of people. So he's busy. Yeah. So don't worry about Jay. Always great seeing you guys. Enjoy. You're here all day, I assume, right? Hanging around. Have a great day, and if I see you in the corridors, say hi to me. But have a wonderful day. The sun will eventually shine here today, I'm absolutely sure of it. So, great seeing you.
So thanks again once more, Peter Moore, for sitting down with us. You might have heard this actually, we're all using the same, since it was a round table, we're all using that same interview. So if you have heard, you might have thought, didn't I just hear that maybe on another podcast? Yeah, we're all using the same one because it was a round table. But it was just such a good interview. I thought I had to put it down. And Peter really, really was very funny in that interview, I have to admit. But next up, let me talk about my time at Microsoft and my preview for Battle for Middle Earth 2 for the 360.
Game previews!
So they flew us out, and they being EA and Microsoft, to show us the Battle for Middle Earth 2 for the 360. I've been to Microsoft many times before, but I've never been to I've been to their main campus in Redmond, but I've never been to their actual Xbox division. I have a lot of friends just from Carnegie Mellon, where it's my alma mater. I have a lot of friends who work in Microsoft and Oracle and all those companies. So, you know, and tons of friends who intern there, but I never went to their Xbox division before. And, you know, one thing that always strikes me about a lot of these companies is that you build them up in your head, and They are either really, really, really cool, or they're really just a very basic company. And this is sort of the later. It is, you know, you show up, it's a corporate park. It's not even on the main Microsoft campus. They're on their own campus. They share these offices with other people. They're spread out in a couple different places. There's like the PR division. There's the actual division that does like the building of the software, and there are different offices. And they're just office buildings. I mean, you show up, it's in this like two-story office complex. You know, there's definitely a Microsoft presence, and the Xbox has a really cool foyer, but it's just an office. It really is. It's amazing how simple these offices usually are. We showed up. We got a demo from the EA guys of Battlefield Miller 2, which I'll talk about in a bit. From there, we talked to Peter Moore. We got a tour. Then we hung out with Major Nelson. We did get to see the actual behind the scenes for Xbox Live, and you'd be surprised. It's again, it's like Xbox Live is all the command and control for Xbox Live is in two really fairly small rooms. It's really quite incredible. They're actually expanding it because they're growing so much. But you think it's this huge command structure where they have all these things. They are manning it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and they did say some funny things about how, you know, when there's special events, you can see spikes in the usage, like maybe during the Super Bowl, there'll be spikes down, you know, like, or during like really big events, you actually see spikes either down or up in certain directions, but they're always monitoring it. One thing that's cool in the back room, they have a copy of every single Xbox Live game ever made for any platform ever, you know, for every language, so they can test them out at any time to make sure there's no problems. Like if someone says they're having an issue, they can pull it up, you know, like, oh, if there's having problems in the Japanese version of Halo, they can pull it up at any time and test it out right then and there. And then actually the servers themselves, you know, it's just a server room. If you've been to any corporate server room with, you know, the rack mount servers, that's what it looks like. It's nothing amazingly special. I mean, sure, there's a lot of green everywhere and there's a lot of Xbox branding, but you would be amazed at how just sort of kind of plain it all is. Not that it wasn't cool as heck, don't get me wrong. There's lots of cool, you know, they had a lot of data, like a little museum that had like the millionth version of Halo, and they had like a gold discs all over the place for any games that sold a lot. They had like statues and awards, like, so for like the millionth version of the Xbox that came off the line, the millionth version of the CD DVD player for the Xbox, you know, so they have all these awards everywhere. They have a lot of, you know, posters for all their newest games. Actually, one of the coolest parts was going to the cafeteria, because they have one cafeteria for everyone. Again, it's a cafeteria, it's a corporate cafeteria. Wow, look, food, yay! No, but it was all the Xbox guys all eat at one place, and there's branding everywhere. So Rise of Legends was all over the place right now, because it's also Microsoft Game Studios, not just Xbox. So you saw a lot of branding of what their current games were. They have, you know, TVs all over the place. They also had one thing that was kind of funny. On the tables, they had information about Brazil, and they had all these on all the TV monitors, they had all this information about Brazil, giving little factoids, and we were saying, why is there Brazil information in the Xbox Live Microsoft Game Studios cafeteria? And they said, well, they're launching into Brazil, and since that's one of the new countries, they're just giving out a little bit of information about the countries they launch into. I was like, ah, okay, that all makes sense. So, you know, average cafeteria food, it was fun. And then we played Battle for Middle Earth for about 5 hours afterwards. So that being, you know, all said, is the Xbox Live campus was as cool as I thought it would be, and yet as mundane as I kind of thought it would be. You know, it's a very simple corporate campus. Everyone's offices look like, if you go to work, it looks like your office. Maybe there's a few more games, maybe not. I've seen some of your offices. I've actually been to a couple people out there who are fans of the show, and I think some of you, actually, I know for a fact some of you have a heck of a lot more games, board games and whatnot, in your offices than these guys do. You know, I'll say one thing is that they do have, like, controllers on the floor, and they'll have, like, you know, there was, like, faceplates all over the place, and I was, like, talking to Tony and Chris, and they're like, oh, yeah, you want a face, you know, just take them, you know, so we get some cool stuff, and, you know, they're just everywhere, so that's what's one nice thing. But it's you know, actually a good example is my wife, who used to work for 17 magazine, was in the masthead for a long time. She actually got a big raise and now works even higher up. But you know, little girls are always real excited to come over and see her working at 17 magazine. But it's just, you know, she's like, you know, it's a job, you know, it's just like an office like any other office. A lot of fun, don't get me wrong. I did used to work at MTV, and I will say working at MTV was as cool as you thought it would be, and actually cooler because there were like rock stars and people wandering the halls all the time. So, and we did get into clubs and parties whenever we wanted, absolutely free. So maybe this is not a good analogy to use. But anyhow, it still was fun. It was still a lot of fun going to Xbox, and it was I highly recommend it to anyone who gets a chance to do it. And definitely try to get a job there. It's worth it. It's fun. Good food in the cafeteria. So getting to Battle for Middle Earth 2 for the 360, I was invited to this event to play Battle for Middle Earth, I didn't even know it was coming out. That's how rare RTSs are for the consoles. And the main reason is because you just can't get the controls down. You know, there's been a lot of very light RTSs, like Goblin Commander came out like a year or two ago. That was actually made by some ex-Blizzard guys. That was a very simplified RTS. Even Pikmin, you'd say Pikmin and Pikmin 2 is kind of a simplified RTS, which I love, by the way. I love that game. And you know, but the real serious RTSs, you need the keyboard, you need the mouse, you need to be able to group and do all this stuff. So it's really, you know, can you do it? Can you take a serious, real RTS and put it on a 360? And it looks like they did a really good job. I was really impressed. Every single control that you could imagine on a PC, being able to group your units, being able to select certain types of units, being able to make quick commands to them, being able to line them up on the battlefield, being able to zip around the battlefield quickly, zoom in, zoom out, everything you can think of was in the game. It was, they didn't take out anything. They just really streamlined the interface. They took out the interface completely. In fact, they just, if you have the most games, like, oh, I'm looking at you, Age of Empires 3, with your interface that takes up 50% of the freaking screen, it's ridiculous, is that this game, there's like almost no interface. There's a map in the corner and some buttons. That's it. It's such a small interface, and it's really nice. It's much smaller than the PC version. And the PC version plays exactly the same. So, but the one advantage of this is that you do get, oh, you know, you can play it on the 360. You do get to play against other people on live, which was a lot of fun. You know, we played a single-player campaign for a while, so we could hammer the controls. But they do say they have a big funny thing where they call it one button to rule them all, is where you could actually play the entire game just hitting the A button. And that's pretty much pretty accurate. You can't play almost the entire game hitting just the A button. You know, if you want to do some crazy things, like select just certain types of troops and then selectively take troops out of your formations that you don't want, you can do that. There's like adding, subtracting, like by pressing the shoulder buttons, things like that. But most times you only have to hit one or two buttons and you can do everything. And I tell you, within just a few minutes, I was able to quickly play this game. And within an hour or two, I was able to zip along and I was playing this game as well as I could play a PC RTS. So I think this is going to be a huge step up. The graphics were great. The graphics really were impressive. You know, it's a beautiful game. For those of you who haven't played the PC version, it's been getting excellent reviews, and one of the big things is the graphics. It's a fun game, and what I like about this RTS is that when you build one unit isn't one unit. One unit is 20 units, you know, so when you build archers, you don't build a single archer. You build, like, 20 archers, and that's your unit. So when you're building, you know, your units, you actually are building huge amounts of units, and you actually are fighting gigantic wars one against the other. It does get a little hectic on the field, but the biggest test of it all was to see how well this would play against other guys who are really good at the PC version. And for whatever reason, I don't know what happened, but Chris from Dream Station and myself, we got teamed up, and we named our name, we thought of like the worst thing you can think of, so we named our team Team Goblin, because those are the things that get killed the quickest, because, oh man, we went up against these Xbox VIPs, not Xbox, sorry, Windows VIPs. These guys were so good at so good at Battle for Middle Earth 2. It was a total joke. I mean, it really was. And they never play the Xbox, and they crushed us continuously. continuously because they just knew tactics. They knew how to play the game, even though they were not, you know, not that comfortable with the controller. They're not console gamers. It's a testament that, you know, someone like me, who I felt I was very comfortable with the controller, was able to play very quickly and easily, was continuously getting absolutely crushed by the PC gamers who knew exactly how to play this game. And you know what? I can't say that would always happen with a first-person shooter, because, you know, I can play a first-person shooter and pick it up even though I've never played it before on a PC, and then go to a console, and I would probably not do any better than the other guy because you're kind of on the same playing field. Because when it comes down to it, a real-time strategy game is strategy. And the better person with the better strategy will often win the game, not the person who knows the controllers better. And these guys were saying, the pros, is that, you know, they were like, you know, they were just using the A button almost the whole time. They weren't doing anything fancy. They just were able to, you know, build better units and know how to crush people. It also has real-time chat, obviously, voice over IP, because it's Xbox Live, so you can play with other people. One of the only downsides, I'd say, is that you can only play four people max for the multiplayer, so that sort of wasn't so great. You know, I mean, four people's more than enough, and actually, I can't think of too many times that I've actually played real-time strategy games with more than three other players when we're playing team matches or against other people, so it's not too bad. But, you know, in this day and age where you're seeing, you know, first-person shooters with 64 consecutive players, you know, and, you know, GAR, which can play ridiculous amounts of people in all these other games, it's like four people seems like not a huge amount, which in reality is probably more than enough. But, yeah, Battlefield Middle Earth 2, really great game. I was very impressed. And it comes out in July. It comes out early July. But if you haven't played the PC version and you're looking for another new game to throw in your 360, and you like strategy, you like, you know, Advance Wars, those type of games, definitely give this one a try. And I like also that it has all the units from, you know, the world of Middle Earth. It really was a great game. I was really impressed with it. And I'm also impressed just that they were able to do this, because then now hopefully other people will now say, hey, you know what? We can make a real-time strategy game. We can put a Supreme Commander on the 360, not just a PC. We can put, you know, well, I guess Age of Empires 3, but, you know, like, you know, something else. Age of Empires 3, I'm only giving it a rap because it didn't live up to the hype, in my opinion. But yeah, this is going to be the first one. And I know for a fact that they're doing this because these are the same guys, the same team who's doing Command & Conquer 3, and they're definitely going to release it for the 360. You heard it here. And so what they're doing is they're really using Battlefield Middle Earth 2 to sort of use it as a springboard to test, to see how it's going to work for the, you know, for Command & Conquer 3. So they're trying to almost use this as a beta, a very good beta. And, you know, as they sort of streamline this, then when they design Command & Conquer 3, they'll be able to get a lot more information, and they'll be able to really come out with a really strong Command & Conquer 3, both for the PC and the 360. And by the way, those of you who are big CNC fans, because I'm a big, huge CNC fan, I'm going to have more information for you later on this year about CNC 3. So I'll keep you in the loop. But with all that, let's talk to the man himself. I interviewed Lewis Castle. It's kind of a quick interview, but I'm going to sit down with him again because he and I were chatting almost the whole time we were there. He's almost the same age as me. He's just a little bit older, and that's actually probably one of the reasons why I actually get a lot of these interviews, because almost everyone I interview is pretty much my age. They're either just a few years younger or a few years older, because we're all sort of the same generation, which is nice. But Lewis Castle, for those of you who aren't familiar, he co-founded Westwood. He's worked with Infocom. He's done Monopoly, believe it or not. He created the Command & Conquer universe. He created Dune 2. He almost invented the real-time strategy game as we know it today. He was eventually bought out and is now the vice president of Electronic Arts for he's the vice president of, I believe, Creative Director, Creative Entertainment. I forgot the exact title. It's actually not on his business card. I'm looking here right now, just as vice president. And he, you know, worked a lot on making sure Battlefield Middle Earth 2 would come over to the 360 and work really smoothly. He's done a great job, and I'm sure he's working on Command & Conquer 3 in some capacity, since that is his baby. But let's sit down and listen to my interview with Lewis.
Interview!
This is Steve here. I'm sitting here with Lewis Castle, Vice President of Creative Development for Electronic Arts. That is a mouthful. How are you doing today, Lewis?
I'm doing just fine, thanks. And you can just call me Lou.
Lou. Louis. But for those who aren't familiar with Louis or Lewis, he is also one of the co-founders of Westwood Studios. They made a couple of games, things like, oh, I don't know, Command & Conquer. I think you probably have heard a couple of those games. Oh, I don't know, things like Dune 2 and things like Blade Runner. You know, you've heard of one or two of those games in the past. And we're actually here to talk about Battlefield Middle-Earth 2 for the 360. So one of the questions I have is, I was actually pretty surprised that you decided to make an RTS for the console, because it hasn't been too successful, or not too successful, it has been a long time since there's been a successful RTS. So what was the thinking behind doing this and sort of going in this direction?
Well, a couple years back, I really wanted to focus my attention on doing something really meaningful, not just for EA, but also for the business. And given a bunch of different brainstorming ideas, one of the things I thought, well, it'd be really great if we could create a game that kind of touched on the core compulsions that we see on PC real-time strategy games, but that was built around a console design right from the ground up. And so that was just a really exciting idea for me.
And we are playing this today, and I have to say I'm pretty impressed so far. It's you know, one of the big failings of RTSs is usually the control scheme, and this one you can pretty much do everything you could do on the PC. You can set waypoints, you can actually select groups and select you know, one single soldier to everything on the screen at once. And I'm actually surprised that it feels like you didn't really hamper the controls from the PC title into 360. How did you go about doing all that? I mean, it's pretty impressive.
Well, we didn't actually try to take the PC controls over to the console. The way that started was with that, what I had mentioned previously, where we literally started from the ground up and said, we want to make a game about controlling, building and controlling armies. And we wanted that to be just a game that felt natural on the console. So we didn't start from the idea of, here's this game we want to make on the console. We started from the idea of, here's this game experience, this emotional and sort of mechanical experience that we wanted to create from scratch. Almost like there never was a PC real-time strategy game. And so as we got closer and closer to, well, we actually built a couple of prototypes and got them to where we felt like, okay, this is almost there. It's just about perfect. Right around the same time, Battle for Middle-Earth 2 on the PC was being finished. We said, wow, what a great game. Let's take all the stuff that makes that a great game and map it over to our interface design that we had come up with. And so that's what you get. So it's a very different approach. Had we started with the game, Battle for Middle-Earth 2, and tried to just make it work on the console, we might have fallen into the same traps that so many people have in the past.
And for those people who have already played the PC game, what will be different in the Xbox version?
Well, you know, first of all, it's different, right? Right from the get-go, when you start out, all the menu systems and everything else are different. But the gameplay experience is the same game. So that's why we called it the same name. We could have made a new name, but I felt that that would be disingenuous to the consumers, because if you've played the campaigns, it's the same campaigns, it's the same maps. However, changing the interface changes the game quite a bit. So it plays very differently, and you might find that it's just a different experience and still a lot of fun, even though you may have played it on the PC. In fact, a lot of guys in there right now are PC gamers. They're having their big smiles on their face, having a good time. In addition to that, we leaned into the things that make Xbox 360 really individual and unique. So we really went into the achievement system and into the live system. We added 4 new multiplayer modes. Implicit in being on Xbox 360 is that all multiplayer games are ranked with the same hardware, which is really nice, because if you're a player and you're at the top of the charts, you know you're just the best, right? So in addition to that, by adding these 4 new modes, we had added a King of the Hill, Resource Race, Hero versus Hero, and Capture and Hold. And what's great about these new modes is they sound like first-person shooter modes, because they are. The game plays a lot more like an expanded first-person shooter than it does a sort of top-down RTS. You really get into the action. So games like Capture and Hold are totally different now, because just 2 people can have a really meaningful Capture and Hold game instead of having to gather up 12 or 20 people to make a really good one. And things like Hero versus Hero are spectacular, because now as you play through the game, you get gamer achievements, which unlock new heroes, which give you all new strategies and all new ways of playing the Hero versus Hero. So we really leaned into the experience of Xbox 360. So if you played the PC game and you thought, well, what's going to be there for you? It's going to be mostly all the multiplayer and online stuff, the voice over IP. All that stuff is going to be really spectacular for you. You're going to have a great time with it.
And one thing you're probably going to hear a lot, because you already heard it a few times today, is, you know, the Xbox 360 does support mouse and keyboard, but yet you can't use mouse and keyboard for this game, and that was a conscious decision. You have to use the 360 controller. Why did you do that?
Well, we didn't just port the game. Had we done that, it would be obviously a slam dunk and really easy, and we would end up with really good keyboard and mouse controls and kind of bastardized, you know, sort of certainly mitigated control scheme for the controller. By ripping out the entire control mechanism of the game, and it sounds simple enough, but you have to understand, we didn't remap the controls. We literally eliminated all of them and then rebuilt it. So there is no direct correlation. When somebody asks me, how do you do XYZ on the PC on the console? I go, well, you don't do it exactly like that, but what you're asking to do is select all of your heroes. Here's how you select all your heroes. So it's different in the sense that if we wanted to support the keyboard and the mouse, we would have had to have adopted the exact control mechanism and remapped it to a controller. This is a very different approach. It's a totally redesigned game from the controller up, and so we can't do that. We can't allow it. It was a conscious decision, obviously.
So actually, I'm going to, since we only have a little bit more time, I'm actually going to switch topics real quick. One thing is that you are pretty well known for your RTS games, obviously Command & Conquer, now Battle for Middle-Earth, but you actually were saying before that you are also a big lover of adventure or story-driven games like Blade Runner, which you worked on. Do you expect to start seeing more of those now in the 360? Are you guys at EA working on more games that are story-driven like that?
Well, as you know, you can't talk about games that aren't announced yet, obviously. But in general, I'm very excited about games that really lean into emotion and story. Mm-hmm. Even if it is a strategy game or an action game, I think the story, the world, the universe, that's the context that helps me finish and sort of fulfill that whole fantasy world. I think that for a while, people went back to mechanics because we had drifted away from them. And the trend was, make a really great playing game, don't worry so much about the story. I'm happy to say that I don't believe that's going to last much longer. I think now you get games, competitors, games like Oblivion or even Assassin's Mark of Creed, which has great promise. And once you see these things, you go, oh, yeah, well, that's definitely where it's going, right? That's the kind of experience that's going to be really innovative and revolutionary. That's not to say that the favorite games we have, the racing games, the action games, the real-time strategy games, they're going to go away. I think quite the opposite. Those are going to be augmented by really powerful stories and great performances.
With that being said, are we expecting to see a little bit more of that in, oh, I don't know, Command & Conquer 3, huh?
Oh, you know I can't talk about it.
I know.
But I will say that everybody that I know at EA is excited about, sort of plussing up the story in our games. Mm-hmm. So there's a backwards answer to that question. Mm-hmm.
And Kane's going to be back, right? Or actually, the actor, the poor portrays Kane.
Not listening.
Okay, I know. Everyone loves Kane, though. It's like, it's the most requested thing. It's like...
You know, I obviously can't speak to that, but right. But I can say that, Joe Kucan, who is the actor who did that role, is a spectacular individual and has done an amazing job bringing that character to life. No matter what the future holds, he's always going to have a special place in everybody's heart. So
what are some of your favorite RTSs? Because you're almost like, I wouldn't say the father, but one of the fathers of the modern RTS, with Command & Conquer and Dune 2. What would some of your favorites, including yours as well as others?
Well, if we include mine, it's got to be Red Alert 2 with Yuri's Revenge, right, or Tiberian Sun, and I'm always back and forth on those two. And they really, truly are my favorites. I mean, and I know people would say, oh, but you made those. It's like, well, yeah, when you get the luxury of making a game, obviously you make one you like.
Right.
And I liked both of those. And actually, Red Alert 2 with Yuri's Revenge, I didn't have so much to do with. Those guys in Irvine, Mark Skaggs and those guys in Irvine, Dustin Browder, who don't work for EA anymore, but those guys really did an amazing job on that product. Then if you go away from my products and you go to something else, I would say probably StarCraft actually is one of my favorites. Just the balance was perfect. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing, amazing game. I had a wonderful time with it.
So one thing is that a lot of people say that Herzog's Y was the first kind of modern RTS, but actually you were saying, and you mentioned this, is that for the Apple II Plus, the Rescue Raiders.
Yeah, this is, okay, so Rescue Raiders had the basic principles of rock, paper, scissors nailed, right, and it was on a linear, it was basically
you had a helicopter, right, and you had to build the little units. Of course I do, what are you talking to? Right. And you had to build you had your enemy helicopter, you had to build the units five at a time, and there was the two engineers, and
I'll give you the quick thing. So why is Rescue Raiders inspiring for RTS? Well, first of all, it's linear instead of two-dimensional. But what's really great about it is it had that rock, paper, scissors. I need to build X unit to combat Y unit that my opponent is building. And then it had the one thing that RTSs all have, good ones have, which is you were creating your own army, you were deploying your own army, you were doing combat, but you had your influence through the helicopter where you could go in and disrupt
So it wasn't just So it wasn't just about build the right thing to counter the right thing. It was also about where are you going to spend your personal time and attention. When you take that idea and you map it to Military Madness, which was on the NEC, and then Herzog's Vi from the sort of mechanics, that if you look at those three and say what's the sort of crossroads of all of those, that's what inspired Dune 2.
Well, I wish we had a little bit more time to talk about Command & Conquer and a few other games, but I'm sure we'll talk to each other again. So thank you very much, Lewis. I'm going to go play some more Battle for Middle-Earth 2. And when is it coming up, by the way?
It's in July. We're releasing it in July.
Okay. Great. Thanks a lot, Lewis.
All right. Take care.
Thanks. Hey, Lewis. Once again, thank you so much for being on the show. I am definitely going to get another interview with you where we can sit down and talk a little bit more. It was sort of a little jam-packed session, so I couldn't sit down with him longer than just a few minutes, but you know, like 10 minutes or so. But next time I'm gonna grill you for an hour, man. And Lewis actually lives in they live in Las Vegas. Westwood was originally in Las Vegas, and it's one of those few studios that actually was there. And yeah, it's pretty cool. It's not too many guys in the Vegas area. I kind of almost wish that gaming took hold in Vegas rather than the LA area, because Vegas sure is fun. But anyhow, with that, let's get to my review of the DS Lite.
Game review! Game review! Game review!
So a lot of people have been asking me about the DS Lite because I've been able to play it before, just at GDC and E3 before in the past. And they knew it was coming out when it came out in Japan. They knew it was going to come out in the US. And the other thing is that almost everyone already has a DS. So, you know, is it worth it to get another DS? And it's not cheap. You know, what was this one? I think it was $129. I forgot what I paid for it. You know, it's like, is there any real reason to get it? I mean, you already have a DS. Does this really do anything more that I need to buy it? So the review isn't so much, what I'm trying to answer here is not, is the DS worth buying? Because that is something you have to decide on your own. The review is the DS Lite worth buying, period, and is it worth upgrading from your original DS? So let's go through this new DS Lite. First of all, I would say that this thing is gorgeous. It looks like an iPod. It's white. It sort of has the same coloring. It sort of has the iPod white coloring. It sort of has that same sheen. And it's just so slick. You know, when I saw the original DS, it was so freaking clunky. It's one of the reasons that I didn't even... It took me a while before I bought it. It was so freaking clunky, and it was ugly and bulky. And I know for a fact that those guys, they released this thing. They probably... You know what? It's going to be one of those big mysteries, but I bet you they released the DS a little bit, you know, in retaliation or to not retaliate, but to make sure that they're keeping up with the Joneses, keeping up with Sony and the PSP. So that's why they came out with that thing. Not so much that they wanted to actually come out with, you know, a actual new system, but that they wanted to make sure that they weren't being, you know, they were going up against Sony. And they came out with this thing and it did great, and it wasn't 100% done at the time. Sort of like the original Game Boy. I actually have my original Game Boy, and I still look at it, and the thing is so bulky, and the screen died nearly right away. As soon as you bought it, the screen died. Pixels, whole lines died on the screen, and the thing barely worked, but people loved it anyhow. And that's what I feel like now. It's like the DS was really nice. It's cool. It actually plays really great games. The two screens work well, but, you know, in retrospect, it's not that great to hold. It's kind of bulky. The microphone's not in a good place. The actual screens aren't really that bright. You know, there's a whole bunch of things. And when you see it compared to the DS Lite, you're going to buy it. It's simple as that. You can't even compare. It's like you look at the screen. First of all, it's so small and compact. The microphone's now in the center. The stereo sound sounds fantastic. I don't know how they did it. They must have redone the speakers or maybe the placement's a little bit better. But you can actually hear, you know, when I was playing the original DS, I couldn't hear the stereo that great. I can actually hear the stereo. It really works really great. The screen is so much brighter. It's a freaking joke. You'll never go back to the original. As soon as you put in a simple game, you get the wow factor of, wow, that thing is nice. The screen is big. It's so much more compact. You can put it in your pocket, no problem. You know, the original DS was a little bit too big. This one is so slick and small, you can put it in your pocket. It's much more comfortable to hold. Even the placement of where the pen is 1,000 times better. It's now on the side, which I really like. And, you know, there's just no comparison. I mean, this thing is an extra $130, but if you love your DS or even just like it and you play it, you know, if you play it on a weekly basis, it's going to be hard for you not to get this thing. And for those who are putting off getting something, getting the DS, I would say now is the time. You should get it. I've been talking to some people, some of my friends who are big PSP players, and you know what? I'm still a big PSP player, although I keep playing the same game. I'm playing Hot Shots Golf for the PSP. I can't stop playing that damn game. I've been playing this game thing since it first came out, and I still haven't finished it because you have to play it like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times to actually finish the game, and there's six courses, and it takes so long to unlock everything. It takes you just, I've been playing for like a year now, it takes just so long. And I said, you know, you got to get a DS Lite because there's just so many good games out for it. And, you know, a lot of them who bought it were really surprised. This was earlier, you know, just how much they were enjoying it because, you know, they thought the games were kiddie, but they're not. There's, you know, they kind of like look kiddie. Like, let's see, I got Super Mario Bros. I got the new, you can hear the new Mario Brothers game. And this game, yeah, Me Mario, it's actually, you know, it looks incredibly childish, but it's a freaking challenging game. And that's something you just got to get over. You know, I say this with a lot of Nintendo games. So you just got to get over the childish factor. I mean, Pikmin's a good example. Game looks totally crazy. It's a weird game. It's very funny. And it's hard as heck. It's a great game. If you like strategy games, really, Pikmin is one of the greatest games I've played. And if you're just taking you won't play it because of the graphics, you're just missing out. Same thing with this. It is awesome. So if you're thinking of upgrading, it's going to be hard not to. I guarantee you go into a store and you play this thing, you're gonna buy it. it's so I warn you. Those of you who are thinking of getting a DS, now's the time. Get this. Don't cheap out. You can get the DS, the original DS, probably for a lot less money, get it used and such. Just spend the extra oomph from the DS Lite is well worth it. It's definitely worth the upgrade. And, you know, this isn't a minor upgrade. It's not like they just tweaked it a little. Like, you know, when they came out with the new Game Boy Advance like last year, they had new Game Boy Advance, now with brighter screen. Well, it was a Game Boy Advance SP, actually. And it was the exact same SP, except it had brighter screen. Big freaking deal. This, brighter screen, better microphones placement, better speakers, better design, cooler looking. It just goes on and on. I mean, every single thing has been redone. And if this thing came out last year at the same time when PSP came out, I'd be honest, I don't even know if there would be a PSP because this thing is so amazing. And I think Sony better really step up so their PSP game production, because I think this thing is, it's already flying off the shelves. I got the white one. Some people said they had the black ones. They actually, one person wrote me, they were in Europe and bought the black one. And there is no region coding for the DSs. So if you want to get a crazy one, to get one from Japan, cost you a little bit more, different color, go right ahead. But yeah, I can't recommend this thing enough. And if you like portable gaming, this is the way to go. Name that game! So welcome to Name That Game, my weekly contest where I will play a sound from a video game and you write to me at game@gamingsteve.com. What's that? Yeah, game@gamingsteve.com. You tell me the name of the game, the platform it's from, and you will win a cool prize that I'll send to you, something totally random. I don't even know what it's going to be. I have like tons of t-shirts. I have some games I send out sometimes. I just send out stuff. And it's I haven't had a complaint yet. So let's listen to last week's game, shall we?
Thy presence is long missed, my liege.
The universe is a yawning chasm filled with emptiness and the puerile meanderings of sentience. Why should you deserve special consideration within it, Augustus, above all else?
I am your servant, my lord. As always, that and nothing more.
Yes, that and nothing more.
So that was actually pretty hard. That was a hard one. But that's why I made it much longer so that people can get a chance. And a lot of people, like, I always tell when they're harder because I'll get more guesses from lots of other types of games. That was actually Eternal Darkness for the GameCube, which Eternal Darkness, man, if you want to go and play a game, if you like horror or adventure or good games, I'd say go buy GameCube and get Eternal Darkness. Even if you hate Nintendo games, this game you'll love because it's an extremely dark and violent game. And it is such a good game. It's almost a retro view. I'll tell you real quick. It's one of the greatest games, I think, of all time. One of the things that made it so great is that the game takes place over the courses of thousands of years, and you're playing multiple characters, I think 10 in total, that are kind of going insane, and the game itself makes you go insane. It really does. It does crazy things. It screws up your controllers. It makes you slowly lose health. It pretends it's erasing your games. It scares the crap out of you continuously. And because of that, you never know what's going to happen. Your characters die or go insane routinely. So you can be playing a character, and then the character is now dying, and you have to finish the level before the character dies. So because of that, and this was brilliant game design, by not making you play one character in which you were always sure was always going to be safe, they made you play multiple characters, which continuously would die and go insane or die horrible deaths, so you never knew what was going to happen. You're always on edge because something horrible could happen at any time. But seriously, get this game. Anyhow, back to the contest. I have here, I take everyone's answers. There was only about like 15, 20 people who got this one right. And I have Alex Dunn. Hey, Steve. Well, might be very late for this, but I might as well give it a shot. This game is from the 6606 show. It's Eternal Darkness for the GameCube. Fantastic game. Anyway, keep up the good work. Alex Fat Baby Dunn. Wow. Okay, Fat Baby. So send me your name and address, and I will send you out something, Fat Baby. I have no idea what I'm going to send you. Send me your t-shirt size, because I got a whole bunch of t-shirts, so I might send you something there. But I'm going to play a game this week. Just send me your guess. You just send the name of the game and what platform it's from at game@gamingsteve.com. And if you're right, I'll throw you in a patch, and I will pick you out. And if you get it, you win. You send me your address, and you get a whole bunch of free stuff. Let's listen to this week's entry.
A med station takes away the hurt, leaves the pain.
So, is that easy or hard? I don't know, because I know what all these are, and people write me and sometimes say they're impossible, but I give you a hint, they're always big games, they're always good games. I'll never put a Bad Boys 2 on there or something like that. I'll never put a really cruddy game that gets bad reviews on there. So, write me, Game of Gaming Steve. Now let's get to show mail. So show mail is where I answer your questions on the air. I will answer written questions, but I usually take the audio ones first. If you want to send me a question, just record an MP3 file. Try to make it 30 seconds or less. You can go over. I mean, don't try to rush yourself. If it's a little bit over, that's fine. And give me your name and where you're from, and just send it to feedback@gamingsteve.com. Just feedback@gamingsteve, and I will get it. And once again, MP3 file, and let's listen to the first question from Chris.
Hey Gaming Steve, Chris here from Scotland. I had a question for you regarding a recent Peter Moore interview in which he stated that Microsoft would be greatly scaling back efforts on the Xbox 360 backwards compatibility front. And I quote from the article, "Nobody is concerned anymore about backwards compatibility. We under-promised and over-delivered on that. It's a very complicated thing, very complex work. I'm just stunned that we have hundreds of games that are backwards compatible. More are coming, but at some point you just go, that's enough, let's move on. Or people aren't as worried about a game being backwards compatible. And I like to think we've upheld our end of the bargain in making at least 200 or maybe 300 games backwards compatible. Now this is very disappointing for me, and I'm sure quite a lot of other people. 90% of my library of Xbox games is still incompatible for the 360. Backwards compatibility was one of the major selling points for me with the 360, and I'm annoyed that they now seem to be going back on their earlier promise of striving for 100% backwards compatibility of all the old Xbox titles. I know Moore makes a point in saying that updates will still come, but I'm just disillusioned that they won't continue to update in the big way that they have been doing so up until now. I would like to hear your thoughts on this. Do you think this announcement will impact sales at all, and do you think that Microsoft is ever going to reach their previous and now retracted goal of full backwards compatibility for all Xbox titles in the 360? Thanks, Steve. Awesome show, by the way.
Hey, Chris from Scotland. So, yeah, Peter Moore. We were talking about him all show. Backwards compatibility. Why are they... Will they ever reach full backwards compatibility with all the original Xbox titles on the 360? No, they won't. Okay, next question. No, I'm just kidding. So, yeah, now they're never going to do it. And the reason is because, I've said this before, they changed their chipset. They changed the graphics chip. And because they changed the chipset between the Xbox and the 360, they have to emulate every single game. So what they're really doing is they have an Xbox emulator that runs these games when they get backwards compatible. And that's why when you have to download these updates, so that if the game gets in there, it sort of changes things around and runs an emulator so that you can actually play the game. Now, why are a lot of these crappy games getting backwards compatibility and all these really great games aren't? One of the main reasons is a lot of these crappy games don't really take full advantage of a lot of hardware tricks, software tricks. A lot of these games do really crazy things, like Oblivion for the 360 really pushes, even though it's one of the very first games, it does a lot of crazy things that pushes the 360s to a limit. It does a lot of caching of content, so it tries to stream faster. It does a lot of memory tricks. You know, so they do all these crazy things, and whenever they're doing this stuff, they actually have to change the emulator around to make sure it can do that. Now, you have all these really simple games. They don't do that. A lot of these simple games really aren't doing much at all. They're just sort of like using the hardcore Xbox development, and they're not trying any crazy tricks. And because of that, they're really easy to port over. So, you know, what they do is they bring these games over, they work. They're not that long games, because there's something else they have to do. They have to play through these games to test them all the way through. And if the games are really big, that can take a while. So, you know, they have to test these games. If they're small games, they can get through them really quickly. So you're seeing on these lists, like, not exactly the greatest games. And then some of these really great games that you might want to see, like, I don't know, like Psychonauts and whatnot, might have, you know, be pulling a huge amount of processor power, doing all these really crazy tricks to get a little bit more out of the Xbox that, you know, like only semi-kosher. So they have to, you know, write an emulator specifically for that game, and then they also do, you know, price point comparison to see how easy it is to get these out. So it's just a nightmare. I mean, it really is. It's just such a nightmare. And the games have to work. They have to test them all the way through. Although I do feel bad for the guy who has to sit there and, like, play the Barbie game, like, all the way through over and over again. Or Kabuki Warrior or something, like, continuously to make sure the thing worked 100%. But, you know, the other thing is, I hate to admit this, I almost agree with Peter Moore, is that, yeah, it stinks that a lot of these Xbox games don't play on the 360, but I popped a few, and I was actually playing Prince of Persia for my Xbox 360, or on the Xbox 360, and it looked so good that it didn't look that good. Does that make sense? You know, because, like, it's so crisp and so clear that I can see all the flaws. And I didn't like that. So I actually stopped playing it. I actually put it back into my Xbox and playing it on that. So in a weird way, it's almost be careful what you wish for, because you can now see, you know, in HD, all the crystal clear clarity. Although the Xbox had it, but it's just so much better on the Xbox 360. I can't believe it. So it's not, you know, I don't think they're always, and not only that, I don't think it necessarily drives sales. You know, it will be a problem when the Xbox is gone, as it is now. It's sort of disappearing. And the 360 is finally in stores. In the New York area, I went to Price Costco, and they had it at Price Club. They had Costco. They had 360s there. They actually had PSPs there too, which was cool. They even have iPods there now, but That's the sign of that they're everywhere, in my opinion. So if you can go into a Costco and see it on the shelf, it's everywhere. So finally, you can get a 360. But yeah, it's going to be a while, man. And if they might just give up on it. I mean, they might just say, you know what? That one of the reasons is because they want to drive 360 sales too. You know, it's sort of cannibalizing. You know, yes, you buy the 360, but they make their games. They make their money on the games, and yeah, they make money on the Xbox games. But they make more money, and they really want to get the 360 install base as strong as possible. So, you know, Peter Moore knows this. It's like, you know, people aren't going to be going out buying the 360 to play all their old Xbox games. They're going to be buying the 360 to play the new games and take advantage of the new capabilities. And I don't know how many people really sit there and play their old games. And I know for a fact that these guys know. They have those stats. In fact, it's very easy to get, because if you are an Xbox Live, they can record that and send that data information back to headquarters. And I used to do stuff like that all the time. I'm really big into taking data and data mining. I love that stuff. And I always sit there and try to figure out the best of everything, how to maximize gameplay, things like that. So I would do that if I was in charge of the studio. Anyhow, let's get to the next question.
Hey, this is Lawrence Roy from Madisonville, Kentucky. And with game prices on the rise, I was wondering, what type of role do you think advertisement is going to play in games in our future? Because I'm pretty sure that the game companies are going to look for other sources to gain more money so that they can lower the prices so that more people will buy the games. Do you think that there's going to be advertisement in our games like in TV, movies, or just not at all?
Hey, Lawrence from Kentucky. That is a great question. With prices on the rise, will advertising help defray the costs? So I tell you this, yes and mostly no. In some cases, advertising will not decrease the costs. Some it will. Let's see. Like some MMOs are now free because they have advertising paying for the cost completely. So that's a few times. Like Anarchy Online is completely free because they have advertising in the game. So you can play that game totally for free. Let's see. Leisure games. Any games that have subscriptions or, you know, or like loose subscriptions. Any games that are like kind of eyeball-based models. Those are free or mostly free because they have advertising on the site or they have advertising in the game, and that's how you're able to pay for it. But those are usually cheap games or games that are just need people to play. It's sort of like a television model. You know, television is free, broadcast television, because they have advertising. But then you have other games like, you know, console games, which now you're seeing advertising in these games. And let me put it to you this way. Movies now have a lot of advertising in them, okay? So are movies any cheaper now than they were 5 years ago? No, not really. At least here they're not. They're $10.75 to see a movie in New York City, and that's what it was a couple years ago. And I got to sit through like 5-10 minutes of advertising, and it's just another revenue stream, you know? They use it to make as much money as possible. Perfect example of this is toll booths. As most of you probably know this, you know, the very first toll booth that was ever put up in the U.S. was actually put up, and the goal was they needed to pay for the bridge. I forgot exactly which one it was. I think it was in New York. They were going to pay for the bridge, and they had this toll booth, and after they got the money to pay for the bridge, they were going to dismantle the toll booth. And you know what? They realized, hey, wait a second. People are paying for this. We paid for the bridge already. Now we got to pay for the upkeep of the bridge. Yeah, that's it, the upkeep. And before you know it, there's toll booths everywhere. And, you know, there are toll booths to pay for the upkeep of the bridge, the toll booths to pay for the construction and the state and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, toll booths were originally put up for the same reason. Like, oh, yeah, it's another revenue stream. It can actually help us lower costs. But did it really? Who knows? Not really. Yes, in some cases, mostly no in others. So now you're not going to see Xbox games go for less. Most times, or PS3 games or PSP games. Now, I say most times because there are a few exceptions to the rule. As I said, the MMOs. Now, the ones are games that are what's called co-branding, like a Cars game or a game that's like a Lion King game or something. That's called the co-brand game, which is that you're branding it like you usually, well, a real true co-brand is you have two brands in there. Like you would have, if you have a Visa credit card with Toys R Us on it, that's a co-brand. You have Visa and Toys R Us branding together. Believe it or not, not the Final Fantasy game, the Kingdom Hearts game is a co-brand game between Squire and Disney. That's a co-brand game. So anyhow, these games, it's the technical terms used in advertising. So these are co-brands or branding games where, you know, you actually can buy them for a lot less. Maybe it's only $20 or something, because the goal of the game is not necessarily to make a huge amount of money on the game. It's actually get the license and the brand out there. And so that is an example of advertising actually working. Yeah, it's a slippery slope. Don't expect huge, you can use your brain, you know. It's like wherever you think there might be, you know, the game might be cheaper, it probably will be, but most times it won't. Anyhow, thanks for the question.
Hey, Steve, it's Shannon from Australia. I was just wondering, I've noticed in the news lately that there's been a bit of reporting about the connectivity between the DS and the Wii. Now, we know that the Wii is going to be able to play GameCube games, and we already know that the DS plays Game Boy Advance games. So will this connectivity extend to being able to play old GameCube, Game Boy Advance games that would have required the link-up cable? I'd really like to be able to go back and play Legend of Zelda: The Four Swords on the Wii with my DS. And I haven't been able to find out anywhere if this is going to be possible. So thanks for that, Steve. Love the show.
Hey, Shannon from Australia. So the DS and the Wii connectivity. Wow. Yeah, you're like, that's a great question. I have heard nothing about that. And, you know, yeah, how is that going to work? Because you have, like, the, you know, Legend of Zelda game, Wind Waker, which had the DS and that had Tingle on it. And I actually played it that way. I actually did it. I mean, like, I had a DS. I mean, a Game Boy Advance. And so I keep saying DS. But, you know what I mean. I had a Game Boy Advance, and I put it on, and I used the, you know, functionality to find extra stuff because Tingle would find you extra stuff. So how are they going to handle that? I have no idea, but they probably won't. They probably, you know, the number of games that had that in it were so small, and the ones that did have it in it, they were extras, except for like one or two. But, you know, was it the Final Fantasy game that you actually had to use the Game Boy Advance? That one, I don't know how they're going to do that one. Maybe they'll never come out with it. Maybe they'll totally redo it. There was the Pac-Man game that also did that. But yeah, I can't think of too many others. You know, like, you know, you can play the Zelda game without ever putting in the Game Boy Advance. So those one or two or three games, they're either going to completely ignore it, or they'll come out with something really cool, like you can plug in your DS, or it's wireless, which actually would be even cooler, and that your DS would do it. And, you know, I can see that Nintendo is one of those companies that they are cool enough, because they know that if they do it with a really big franchise like a Mario or a Zelda or even a Pac-Man, that they probably get some press on it, and they probably get some good PR for doing something like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw the Wii, if you're playing a backwards compatible GameCube game on the Wii, that the DS could then serve as the Game Boy Advance for that game. I wouldn't be surprised if we see this for games like that, just because of the huge install base of now DSs and anything that would help out the Wii sales. And also that would, you know, if it's not too hard for them. And considering they use almost all the same hardware structure, you know, Game Boy, Wii is basically a really advanced Game Boy, a GameCube, and the DS is sort of the same thing. I mean, a little bit more. The DS actually is more than that, but it's, you know, fully compatible with almost all Game Boy Advance games. I think we're going to see that. Yeah. Next question.
Hey there, Gaming Steve. This is Chris from Arizona, aka Bayamoose. I have a question about the strategy genre. I'm a big fan of how the Total War series has blended the turn-based and real-time archetypes. To me, they've eliminated most of the weaknesses from those subgenres and created a much more fun and challenging game. So my question is, why haven't we seen more games moving to the Total War model? Most strategy games are still stuck in a turn-based or RTS molds. The only creative assembly seems to be running with this blended model. Is this because the other models work and the developers are kind of risk-averse? Or have those two archetypes been around so long that their fans are married to them and really wouldn't accept a Civ game with real-time battles or a Command & Conquer game with turn-based campaign map? Thanks for listening. Keep up the great podcasting.
Chris from Arizona. So why aren't more RTSs going towards the Total War model? Why are they still using that old-style RTS model? Well, I'll tell you why, Chris. The RTS model, like Command & Conquer and Warcraft and Starcraft, is really popular. Really, really popular overseas, especially. And they make a lot of money. And the Total Wars, they have a very, very lucrative niche. It's still a niche. It's not, you know, it's not the same thing. You know, I'll give you a good example. Empire Earth. Empire Earth did okay. It didn't do that great in the U.S., but it sold over 1 million copies in Germany alone, and it did really well overseas. It did very well in Europe. And that is why they come out with the RTSs, because they do great. They actually not just do great in the U.S., they often do great overseas and do even better numbers. They also, if you have RTSs, you can bring them into tournaments, which are really big overseas, especially South Korea. It's not just StarCraft. They play a lot of other games. So, and also, you know, someone is always probably looking for the next StarCraft. You know, someone's going to replace StarCraft one day, and it's going to probably be an RTS, not probably a Total War. I love Total War, and one of my best friends is probably the best Total War player in the universe. This guy has played Total War every single night since it came out, period. And this is all he plays. And he gives himself ridiculous handicaps. Like, he'll go into battles with 3-1 troops and still win, and give him like the worst troops possible and put the computer on super hard difficulty, and he wins, no problem. I mean, this guy is really, really good at Total War. But, you know, he's also a crazy history nut who subscribes to all those history magazines, the ones that you see in the newsstands, and you wonder, military history, who subscribes to these magazines? Who reads this? He does. You know, these are the type of people. It's a niche market, and it's just big enough that they pretty much own that market. And you can look at it two ways. You can look at it that you can come out with another game like Total War that hopefully that market will embrace. But it has to be just as good, or at least offer something a little different. So that's risky. Or you come out with it and it stinks and you lose, no one buys it. So if you buy it, if you make an RTS, even the crappy ones still sell because it's just a numbers game. You know, like if millions of people are buying an RTS, if less people, and if it's crappy and not as many people buy your crappy one, it's still going to sell. It won't sell millions. Maybe it'll sell only a couple thousand copies, 10, 100,000, but you'll still make money. Total War, not so much. You know, and that's really the main reason. You know, RTSs do really, really well, and I can see that's why, you know, these guys are doing at EA for Battle for Middle-Earth 2 for the 360 is that, you know, the RTS genre has to eventually conquer the console, and that will also help them in countries like Asia and countries in South Korea, Japan, China, you know, where they really play these games, and the PC is still king over there because they play these games. So I would actually be curious to see Total War go onto the console, because that game would actually be a great console game. I'm kind of surprised they haven't done that or bring it onto the 360. But that's sort of the reason, man. I hope you enjoyed the answer, and let's take the next one.
Hello, Steve. This is Quentin from Ohio, and my question is, why can't Microsoft gain any ground in the Japanese market? The Japanese gaming subculture seems to be almost fanatical about anything made by Sony or Nintendo, but shun anything from Microsoft. Being that the PS3 is actually going to be bigger and heavier than the original Xbox, that obviously can no longer be seen as a valid reason for it not selling well in the first round. I have no doubt that the PS3 will sell out at launch regardless of its soaring price, and every time Nintendo releases an upgraded handheld is treated like the second coming of Christ. Even though Microsoft is trying hard and getting heavy-hitting Japanese developers in this round, they're still not gaining any ground. What do they have to do? Thanks, Steve. Love the show.
Hey, Quentin from Ohio. Wow, really good sound quality. That sounds better than my show. You tell me how you recorded that, actually. I'm kind of curious. That really sounds good. So why can't Microsoft gain traction in Japan? You know what? There's no answer. I mean, there's no one answer. Everyone will say something different. There's a million reasons why, but I'll give you a couple of reasons why, at least my opinions. First of all, the launch wasn't that great. They came out in Japan, but right away they had problems. They didn't come out with good games in Japan. Japan has very different tastes. I would say, and I say this often on my show, if it wasn't for Halo, the Xbox would probably be dead. Halo, you know, Xbox had a very terrible launch lineup. It was really subpar. They had Halo, and that was pretty much it. And then after that, they didn't have anything for a very long time. Well, they don't like Halo in Japan. They couldn't care less about Halo. So imagine that launch lineup of, like, Shrek and God, awful games for the Xbox. And that was it, okay? Would you buy one? No. And in Japan, they already had so much competition. So that's the first strike against them. They had really bad game lineup. The second strike against them is the size. It's big, okay? Japanese homes are very small, most of them, okay? A quarter of people live in Tokyo, in the entire country. It's either 20 or 25%. Tokyo, it is so small. I mean, you don't realize how small it is, okay? A lot of people probably live in normal-sized homes. For those of you who live in L.A., well, even L.A. is pretty big. For those of you who live in New York City or Tokyo or London, you know what I'm talking about, or Rome. You have a small apartment probably, and every inch of that apartment is being used up. And if you buy something, you usually have to think where you're going to put it in your apartment before you buy it. Well, you know what? I even have problems with my Xbox, and you know, that thing was just a monster. I mean, it's no question, you know, it's no coincidence that right now, very, you know, it's like the GameCube is very small, Game Boy Advance, you know, Sony, they redid it very small, which also makes it really puzzling why they're making the PS3 so big. But, you know, everything is really tiny because you just don't have a lot of room. And that thing was a monster. And that was a big strike against it. Number three was the size of the controller. The controller was horrible. I know a lot of people who still like the big controller, but you know what? It was too big, okay? I have very small hands. I never even played it. I waited till the S controller came out in the States. The controller was terrible. That's actually been stated by a fact in public. At the GDC and a few other places, they actually said it was just the controller was too big, and it just it was not designed well for your average Japanese gamer. A lot of kids can't play it. You know, it's just I'm not being racist here. You know, a lot of Japanese people are smaller. They're shorter than your. I'd say you know. I don't know. They're shorter, period. Same way, if you go to Norway and everyone's 6 feet tall. I was there. I was like freaking midget. I was so freaking short. I couldn't believe it. But and you know what? You have to design for that. You know, you have to design for the market. And they are, you know, much shorter. So the controller was too big. There was a whole, and that sort of was sort of the downfall. I mean, they messed up the launch, and they were never able to really recover. And when no one has it, it's sort of a stigma they got to get over. And the thing is, and Peter Moore said something very interesting. I don't know if I didn't listen to the interview. I didn't re-listen to it recently. All the way through that I posted. I don't know if, did he say it there? Yeah, he did. It's that you know Japan is one country, and. You know, they have a whole world now, you know? It's like, yeah, okay, Japan is important, and there's a lot of gaming there. But you know what? China has over 1.5 billion people, okay? India has over 1 billion people, okay? You take over China, you take over Japan, you take over Russia and Europe and North America and South America. You really think people are going to care about Japan anymore? I mean, I hate to say it, but it's kind of true. It's sort of like, yeah, you know what? They're kind of right. If, you know, Japan, it's an important market and it's a dominant market. You know, sort of like selling cars and not having cars in Germany because, like, it's considered like the king of cars to be in Germany or, like, you know, having food that's not in France, you know. There can be a stigma associated with it, but at the end of the day, if you're selling 100 million units of the Xbox 360 worldwide and none of them are getting sold in Japan, I really don't think Peter Moore and Microsoft's really going to be too worried. But they're trying. They're coming out with Blue Dragon. They're coming out with a whole bunch of games, and they're slowly getting developers over. So we will see. And finally, I will say that a lot of developers in Japan only develop for the PlayStation, and that's it. And that's it. They do nothing but the PlayStation, and that also is a big problem. And that's why the PlayStation 3, that's why they've been so cocky. Sony's been so cocky because they know it's going to sell well because they have so many people that are locked into that format. They have developers out the wazoo in Japan that have to develop for the PlayStation. They have nothing else. They can't develop for anything else because that's what they make their money on. So it's going to sell no matter what, and they know it. So that's kind of why they've been doing all of that. Let's get to the next question.
Hey, Steve. This is Joe from Orlando. I have a question I've been wondering for a while, and maybe you could answer it. With games like Doom 3 and Oblivion, we practically needed to buy new computers to play them. These games took years to develop, though, so I'm wondering, do the developers know what kind of computer specs people will need when they start working on the games? Or is this like what you were talking about before, where it's just the engine that takes so long? Either way, when do they know what kind of computer specs people will need? Thanks, Steve. This is the best gaming podcast out there. Bye.
Hey, Joe from Orlando. So when do developers know their specs for a first-person shooter? And yeah, first-person shooters, well, let me explain something, is that all games are designed with, they sell different types of games for different technologies. So for instance, a real-time strategy game doesn't necessarily have to have the greatest technology in the world as long as it has really good play balance and it looks pretty. Games like The Sims and other games, as long as they have really good social interaction and social content and vehicles, they'll do really well. And this is all very well known. There's a lot of books on this. If you actually read books, there's like a few out to tell you like how to get a job in the game industry or how to make games, and they'll go through this. And number one for a first-person shooter is technology. What sells first-person shooters is technology. It's almost storyline is secondary, and there's a very good reason. It's because these engines, especially for first-person shooters, are big money. Because Crytek, the guys at id, Half-Life 2, you know, they'll make the engine, they'll make the game, and the game is in many ways nothing more than a marketing tool for the engine. And then they'll sell the engine to another developer for like $500,000 or $1 million or something, and then that's where they really make their money in the long run, is that they'll sell the engine a couple of times and then they'll be heavily modified. And that's why it's so important to come out with these really, really good engines. The thing with the technology is that they always are pushing it because they expect these engines to be around for a while. So, yeah, it might barely work now. I mean, look at The Sims. When The Sims first came out, which is only kind of a little strange because it kind of counters everything I just said, but it's true. The Sims, when it first came out, this thing, I can barely run it on my machine. And I had a killer machine. I always have a killer machine. I mean, I'm playing Oblivion 1600 by 1200 with anti-aliasing on, and it actually is running pretty fine, actually, 30 frames a second, no problem, with high textures. And The Sims just crushed my machine. And I play The Sims now, and it still hurts my machine, which is kind of surprising. It doesn't quite like The Sims that much. But with the first-person shooters is that they know that these things are going to last a while. Like, you know, look at Half-Life 2. I mean, yeah, a year or two ago when it first came out, it was, you know, really, really crushing people's machines, but now it's not so bad. And another year or two, it's going to be pretty, it's going to be kind of eh. And if you really want to laugh, like, look at a game from, like, 5 years ago, you know, like, put in, like, Everyone Lives Forever, or something like that, and, you know, or System Shock 2, and you'll be like, wow, what the heck happened there? So... and when they develop these games, they develop the engines. They actually are able to develop them without any of the textures or anything in it. They're doing a lot of the physics. They do a lot of the actual graphics. They'll put a lot into it that doesn't require heavy systems to actually create the engines. So they know ahead of time. Like, they know what chips are coming out. These guys work. The people who make first-person shooters, they work with the guys who make the chips, that work with ATI, and they'll actually get these chips, these, like, proprietary experimental chips that aren't coming out for another year or two, and they actually get them in their studios, and then they get to actually try the games out on what these are going to be like. And then they get a souped up computer, you know, they put in like multiple processors, they put in a ton of RAM, they get these experimental boards that won't be out for a year or two, and then they try them out and to see how the games run. So that's how they're able to do that. And it's very tricky because they have to make sure it's really strong but not too strong. And that's why, you know, the games are made, you know, so you can really bring them down. And yeah, it's tricky. First person shooters are one of the trickiest things to make, but that's how they do it. And well, I hope that answered your question, and let's get to the last one.
Hello, Heartbreak Rich here again. I think I must be one of the three people who liked Game Talk, because my question is about demos. When does it make the most sense to create a demo, and when should a demo be released, and do these answers change based upon the game's platform? Having seen some Xbox 360 demos that come out early with poor quality or come out months after release, I've been curious about what the developers are thinking when they decide to do a demo. Thanks, Steve.
Hey, so I'm kind of running out of time, so I'm going to get the answers going quick, Nick, Heartbreak Ridge, as you have here. So when does it make the most sense to release a demo? Okay, so demos, there's two huge schools of thought on demos. The first school of thought is let them try the game out beforehand so they can get hooked and buy it. And then second school thought is the exact opposite, which is don't let them try out the game beforehand, because then they won't buy it. And there's arguments on both sides. I am one of those people who tries out a demo, and there's a very good chance that I will then never buy the game, because I was like, oh, I got my fix. I tried the game. I don't need to play it. But other people, they want to see a demo before they play it and before they buy it. So when did they decide to release a demo? You know, most times they decide whether or not they're going to release a demo is because if they have enough time in the schedule. I kid you not. That's it, all right? Because a lot of times these guys, they're making these games to the very last second, and they don't have time to make a demo. So you're wondering, why isn't there a demo? There's no demo because they don't have time to make one, okay? They're just trying to get the game finished. And the worst thing you could do is release a demo that has bugs in it or mistakes. And releasing a demo is really hard work because you have a final game, okay? The game might be, I don't know, like a gig, especially if they're on DVDs. The final game might be 2 gigs. Or look at Oblivion. It's 4 gigs. So are you going to release a 4-gig demo? No, of course not. And that's it zipped, by the way, and all compacted. It's 4.2 gigs on a DVD. So would you, you know, how do you release that? So you got to go in, you got to cut everything out. You have to take it, you have to trim it, you have to make sure it works. But you don't, you know, so you have to, it takes a long time to do. Then maybe when you're doing that, you might accidentally delete some AI that you weren't supposed to, and then you were deleting textures you might not have should have, and maybe this is, you know, the coding wasn't so great in this one area, so that these areas you have to keep in that have nothing to do with the area that you're demoing has to be put in. So it's really, it's like that. It's you know, it's hard to make a demo. And if you have really good coders that are people are thinking ahead of time, they come out with demos. They're nice and small, compact. You know, they're much smaller than the actual game. And they can come out way ahead of time, and they're very good, they're a very good demonstration of what the gameplay is like. Other times, they're bad. They're bad demos. And, you know, that's really, I hate to say it, it's really, that's kind of all there is to it, is the demos really are more technological problems than marketing issues. The marketing people would probably always want demos out because they can use them now to put them on discs for, when a PC game or whoever, when they come out with it. But other people, like the guys at Oblivion, at Bethesda, you know, they probably think, you know what, they want the game, just buy it, all right? Really, really big games usually don't come out with demos because they don't need to come out with demos. I will say I am really enjoying the demos on Xbox 360, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of those, not just on the Xbox, but on the PSP and the PS3. And I even see them now in the DS. If you go to one of the download stations, you can download demos, and it was great. Although I have to say, I am true to my word. I downloaded the Tetris demo for the DS, and I had so much fun playing it that I never bought Tetris DS because I kind of got it out of my system. So, oh well. So anyhow, there you go. There's your answer. If you have any questions you want to send me, you can send it to feedback@gamingsteve.com, and I will most likely put it on the air. I don't have time right now for written questions. I'm sorry. I usually try to write back to you if you write me a question, though, and record your audio, and let's get to final thoughts.
Final thoughts.
Wow, that was a crazy long show. So I apologize I didn't have a show last week, but here you go. Here's the extra super duper long show. I had too much. I didn't have enough last week for a good show. That was one of the issues. I really didn't have any mail, and I didn't have anything I really wanted to review because I didn't get the DS, and I was kind of busy, and I was like, you know, I didn't really have a good show to put together, and I was trying to put it in, and it was all crud. So I knew this was going to be a good week, so I figured, you know what, I'll just give you a huge, extra big show that can almost make two shows in one, because last week's show probably would have been super short anyhow. But actually, I have some cool interviews I have now for next week as well, so I got some stuff coming. And I tried something new this week. I actually used Direct to Drive. If anyone ever used that before, it allows you go to Direct to Drive. It allows you to buy a PC game, and allows you to just buy it, download it, unlock it, and then use it on your computer. I really liked it. I actually bought Oblivion on my computer this weekend and tried it out. And the reason is because, it sounds crazy, but I have not been able to play my 360 version for a variety of reasons, because I only have one TV, so I can't really play it. I can only play it really late at night, and I've been kind of busy, and I'm really big into baseball, and I've been watching my Mets play, who are kicking the crap out of everyone. It's awfully great. And I've been watching a lot of West Coast games, so it's late at night, and it's like, okay, should I watch baseball, or should I play Oblivion, or play a 360 game or something, or a console game? And baseball's been winning out every time, but I really wanted to play Oblivion and finish it up, so yeah, I'm crazy enough, I bought the PC version, so now I can do both. Now I can play Oblivion on my PC and watch TV and baseball at the same time at night. But what happened is I wanted to try out Direct Drive, so I bought it, I downloaded it, big download, 4.2 gigs, as I said, but it worked great. It installs, and then my favorite part is no disc. You don't have to use a disc anymore, thank God. Ugh, I kid you not, more times I will not play a game because I don't have the disc in the drive. And I'm like, you know, I don't have the disc. I don't want to go get it. I'm not playing that game. It's so freaking annoying. I cannot wait when people finally figure out that you don't need to do that. It's like the antiquated way to do copy protection is to make sure the disc is in the drive. I hate that way of doing copy protection. The only downside with the Direct to Drive I noticed is that when there's updates, like there was an update to Oblivion, you can't download the updates from the main website because there's special code in there and you have to download the special update from the Direct to Drive site. So that kind of stunk. I did not like that. But It wasn't too bad because, you know, I downloaded it, it worked fine, but I just don't like it being reliant on a third party. It's like, you know, it's like buying, you know, a TV or a stereo at Crazy Eddie, who used to be this place there in New York City that existed, that was Electronic Center, and then you get their warranty for 5 years, and then they go out of business, and then you just wasted your money. You know, I feel like that. I'm always like hesitant when I'm like, you know, what happens if Direct Drive goes out of business? Then I'm screwed, man. I can never get updates to this game ever again. So that's my only hesitance. But it was easy, and you want a fix. You know, digital distribution, everyone's talking about it, and oh man, the more I use it, the more I love it. Especially, I got a new super duper and crazy insane high speed line. I was downloading a meg a second, so you know, even 4.2 gigs didn't take too long, and it was pretty sweet. And then I just got a new 750 gigabyte hard drive, added a third drive to my computer, so. Filling that up with games, man, and podcasts. This one mostly because it takes a lot of room. So anyhow, I'm going to wrap this thing up because this is a freaking long-ass podcast. And once again, I want to thank all the guys at EA. I want to thank Aaron Kaufman, who actually put together Community Manager from Middle-Earth. And, you know, thank him a lot. Lewis Castle from EA, of course. Tony Hines from Xbox, who also is the Community PR Manager. He helped out a huge amount. Really, thanks a lot, Tony. Everyone at, you know, Peter Moore, of course, but... Yeah, thanks for all of that. If you have any questions, you know, write to me. If you want some questions about the campus or anything I saw there, you know, send me a question. Do a show mail question because I'd rather answer it on show mail than just write you back so I can share it with everyone. So send that to me at feedback@gamingsteve.com. Otherwise, have a good gaming week, everyone, and I will talk to you next week. See ya. Bye.
Listening to Gaming Steve. Until next week, maybe you should see someone about that carpal tunnel syndrome.